You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern's work is supported by the Ecumenical Church of the Savior, which strongly believes that church, synagogue, mosque leaders must find ways to find their voice and speak out. There's something he disagrees with me on. He has been studying, analyzing Russia for more than five decades, both in academe and government. He was a senior analyst at the CIA during the 1980s. He also conducted early morning briefings one-on-one of the president's daily brief for President Reagan's most senior foreign policy advisors. He is also a terrific advocate for peace and has been for many years. Ray McGovern, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
I could have sworn I had had you on this show before, and I have not, and that is an incredible failing. So it is very good to have you on.
That's why you're giving me 2 hours right now, correct?
Well, this will be the first half hour, and we'll catch up on the rest of that in the coming months, I hope. But I had to have you on, even though I thought I already had you on, because you've been such an informed and important and rare voice on the Russiagate madness that has swept Washington, D.C., and because this week, more than at any time in the past several years, we see the conflict between the United States and Russia taking potentially catastrophic form through the increase in hostility in Syria.
Without exaggerating the significance of what happened on Sunday when a U.S. plane shot down a Syrian jet. Well, let me just say it's impossible to exaggerate the significance of that. You'll recall that on April 6th, President Trump decided to gin up his popularity numbers, shooting 59 cruise missiles into an airfield in Syria. Russians reacted pretty calmly to that. They had been warned ahead of time, 2 hours ahead, hey, get your people out of there, we're going to bomb it, we're going to strafe it. They didn't really do an awful lot other than complain. One rhetorical statement, which did matter, was the Prime Minister of Russia, Dmitry Medvedev, saying, you know, we used to have an atmosphere of trust with the United States, now there's a complete absence of trust. They can't figure out, the Russians can't, whether Trump did this all by himself or that Mad Dog Mattis and McMaster at the NSC advised him to do it. Our information is that he did it all by himself. Thank you very much. Talking with Jared Kushner and his daughter. And then he asked McMaster and those to fill in behind and do a quasi-intelligence memorandum justifying it. Back to the point here. How did the Russians react? Well, one would have thought that they would have canceled participation in this joint exercise, this joint headquarters located, in Syria and in Jordan, where they deconflict these flights. Now, they did not do that. It continued unabated, and the militaries of both countries, that is, Russia and the United States, including Syria and Turkey and Jordan and even in Britain, they all continued to coordinate and, as they call it, deconflict these flights. So an incident such as happened on Sunday would be avoided. Whoops, all of a sudden, what happened on Sunday? We knew in advance because the Russians told us. The Syrian flights were being conducted in that area, and we shot that plane down anyway.
Yeah. Now, here you're using "we" to mean the U.S. government in this case.
Yeah, I'm using the U.S. government. Yeah, I used to be part of that. Now, what does this mean? Well, you know, if they're not going to deconflict anymore, we're back to square one, and I date square one. Back to last summer, when the Ministry of Defense spokesman said, look, enough of this foolishness. We're going to shoot down everything that flies over Syria. Please don't be deceived into thinking that these so-called stealth aircraft are immune. We're going to shoot them down, too. And last but not least, you know, Syria is not very big. We won't have very much time to warn anyone. This is the warning. This is the last warning. There's not time enough to identify who owns these planes. Whoa. Well, that was the worst of it. And that was the statement of the spokesman of the Defense Ministry. Today they've said the same thing, pretty much. They've said, look, this is it. We don't want this to happen anymore. We're going to target anything that flies. And please, be advised that this is it. So the deconfliction, I would guess that they'll still meet in these deconfliction centers, but I don't expect the Russians to take seriously any deconfliction that would end up in shooting down Syrian or, worse still, Russian planes.
What the Russians said on Sunday or Monday, Ray, if I'm not mistaken, was any U.S. or coalition planes east of the Euphrates, they will shoot them down. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, it should be east of the Euphrates. Some of the press reporting are saying west of the Euphrates, but that doesn't make an awful lot of sense. So I'm sure you're right. So where are we here? We're at a situation where President Putin doesn't know who's running our Air Force. Now, back in September of last year, you'll recall that, to his credit, Obama ordered John Kerry to work out a ceasefire in Syria with his opposite number, Lavrov. Last summer, it was very clear that the Russians felt that they had been mousetrapped. After 11 months of tough negotiations between John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, approved personally by Putin and Obama both, there was a ceasefire agreed to on the 9th of September. On the 12th of September, it went into effect. On the 17th of September, U.S. Air Force planes bombed known fixed Syrian positions on the top of hills and killed almost 100 Syrian forces and wounded many others. Now, what did Putin say about that? Well, he waited a couple of months, and at Valdai, the big conference they have every year, he said, look, you know, it's really kind of confusing to us. I conclude an agreement with the President of the United States. In that case, it was Obama, of course. And then it appears that not everyone in Washington obeys the commander-in-chief. What do you mean? He meant that the Secretary of Defense and his minions there decided to scuttle the ceasefire that had been worked out for 11 months before. John Kerry himself, in an interview with the Boston Globe, said, you know, there were not everybody agreed in Washington about what I concluded with Lavrov and that Putin approved. So, you know, it's really good. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that if Putin doesn't trust that even the president can restrain people that enjoy calling themselves mad dogs, you know, the tripwire is much lower than it has been in years. And if these folks or these General Keynes or the Ralph Peters or the Mad Dog Mattises or the Dunfords or the Marine Generals of our country decide, well, hang on, well, stealth, they get down, we'll show them a thing or two, we'll put a couple of stealth in it. They will be shot down, and then we will be in a kind of propaganda situation which will, quote, justify, end quote, even more escalation. This is a very, very dicey time, David.
We're speaking with Ray McGovern, and we will have links up to his work and his website at Talk Nation Radio. Ray, it seems to me like in this moment of crisis between two nuclear-armed governments, the top priority among good liberal Democrats in the United States remains pushing evidence-free accusations against the Russian government, which seems absolutely bizarre if we hadn't gotten used to it over the past several months. What is your take on this phenomenon?
Well, it is bizarre. Now, if you look at the following day, we're talking the shoot-down Sunday, following day Monday, okay? Where did this report appear in the New York Times? Oh, it was on the inside page, A10, okay? Was there anything on the front page? A real little, you know, minuscule little blurb saying, whoops, yeah, there's a shoot-down. Okay, go to page A10. Washington Post, page A9. What's on the front page? Obfuscation, not obfuscation, but obstruction of justice, all over the front page and on the early inner pages. So you're quite right, David. It's bizarre here in Washington. It doesn't seem that even, especially the, quote, progressive Democrats, end quote, if any, that they have any sense of responsibility for letting this thing get out of hand. They don't care very much. They've imposed their Senate voters 98-2 to put more sanctions on Russia. So this could easily lead, needless to say, not only to increased tensions with Russia, but the shoot-down of a U.S. plane, the capture of U.S. Air Force personnel, and then you get into a very, very sticky situation where neither side wants to back down. And Syria has suffered enough over this. There was a prospect of working together on this. This just makes it immeasurably more difficult to do that.
And how do you explain so many people, including Trump supporters who applaud it, having come to believe that Russia gave Trump the presidency? Well, to my mind, and as far as I know, to yours, we just haven't seen a shred of evidence to support that claim.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's bizarre about these investigations, David, is that in my experience, and I've been around here 50 years, usually you have a crime to investigate. I mean, like Watergate, you had a crime to investigate. This time there's no crime. There's just a cabal comprised of the FBI, CIA, and NSA, saying, we assess and we assess and we assess some more. We assess that the Russians interfered with the election. Well, we assess. Where's the beef? Where's the evidence? Well, there isn't any. And this makes it very difficult because when you have a campaign motivated by a two-pronged effort, okay, the first prong is, you know, what I call is the HWHW virus. It's very virulent. It descended on our country on the 10th of November. It's the Hillary would have won virus. Okay. Now, there are all kinds of otherwise sensible people who suffer from PTSD. That's what it's like. I mean, it was such a shock that Hillary didn't win. And it's beyond belief that it could have been because Hillary was a fatally flawed candidate who nobody trusted. That couldn't be it. And so very early on, who was it to blame? The Russians. The Russians did it. The Russians. But the Russians aren't WikiLeaks. That's okay. WikiLeaks work with it. The whole thing was orchestrated and played to a hilt by the New York Times, Washington Post. And that's what's really, really scary here. Because without a semblance of evidence, they've not only tried to justify why Trump is in office, namely with the Russians, but they've also tried to sabotage and have been so far able to sabotage. The only sensible thing that Trump has ever said over the last couple of years, and that is that there's no reason on God's earth that there can't be a decent relationship with Russia. Okay? That's what they're at. Now, you know, David, better than most, that peace is very, bad for business. That war tension, tension, especially in Europe with Russia there, I go, oh, man, that's very, very good for business. And so it's what Pope Francis called the blood-soaked arms traders, the arms manufacturers, and the congressional people who benefit from all this by taking part of the take and using it to get reelected and then appropriating more money. I mean, this is a great country or what? That's what's at foot here. They want tension. They don't want a decent relationship with Russia because they want a justification for continuing with this massive arms buildup that that Trump is behind and that congressmen profit from and profiteer from, partly because of the jobs it brings to their community.
Well, I have to agree, but of course, peace would be good for most businesses, not for the arms trade, but for other businesses, and they keep quiet and they don't demand it. But I think that the motivation of the arms trade, of the warmongering, of the xenophobia, of the Russophobia, has to be a big element here, because otherwise, it seems to me there are 18 other excuses ready to hand for not looking into any self-examination of flaws in having rigged the election, the nomination for Hillary, because number one, she did win. Blame the Electoral College. Number two, Trump cheated and fought counting ballots where they existed in every court case and intimidated people, engaged in threats of violence and voter intimidation. And you had Republican secretaries of state strip people from the rolls on a racial and prejudicial partisan basis. I mean, you had the money corrupting the system. You have the media, and you have the guy who's now investigating the Russia madness, or claiming to, Comey, having actually gone out and said something potentially seriously detrimental to Hillary Clinton's campaign, potentially illegally, and they don't seem to care about that one either.
Well, it's really hard to think about the Democratic Party of Franklin Roosevelt, which was the party under which I grew up. They're a bunch of wimps, let's face it. Hillary didn't even sneeze when a lot of this stuff happened. Kerry didn't contest things that happened in Ohio. What's his name? Vice President?
Gore.
Gore, my God, They all folded. So they got no guts. And when you got a bully like Trump, that's a bad combination. No guts on one part, on one side, and a bully on the other. Now, with respect to Comey, I mean, what's happened here is bizarre. I mean, here we have a guy who leaked a ostensible memorandum that he composed on his laptop as soon as he talked to Trump. And he charges that Trump said, it'll let go the investigation about General Flynn. He's a good guy. He's been fired. Why don't we let that go? I hope you can let that go. Okay, so I hope. Now, I remember when Comey was testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee maybe 2 weeks ago or so, and one of the senators says, well, now, Mr. Comey, I'm a former prosecutor, and so are you. Now, have you uncovered, or do you know of any case where someone was accused of obstruction of justice because they expressed a hope? And Comey said, well, he said, no, look, you're a prosecutor, so I'm a prosecutor. Has anybody been even brought to trial because they expressed a hope? And Comey says, no, sir, I suppose they're not. So we don't even know what's in Comey's memorandum. But if it's as reported, as leaked by Comey himself to the New York Times, well, all he says is, I hope you can let this thing go away. And that's a far cry from something that's indictable or pursuable, it seems to me. Now, what happens? Well, Comey says without any apology, so I didn't personally leak that. I just told my folks to leak that to the New York Times, and they did. And my purpose, says Comey, was to get a special prosecutor nominated to get this thing underway, and it worked. And so that's why I did it. Now, the day after, deputy attorney general named a special prosecutor, and who was it? One of Comey's best pals, comrades in arms, former FBI director Bob Mueller. Now, you couldn't make this stuff up. Here, he acknowledges why he leaked this so-called memo, and where's the memo now? Where is it? Oh, he gave it to Bob Mueller. So with this deft move, Comey has kept the memo out of public circulation, out of the press, and away from the Congress. Okay? Who's got it? Bob Mueller. Now, you hear or you read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post that Mueller and Comey are very distinguished, incredibly universally respected figures. That's, well, what we would, in the Bronx, we'd call that a crock, okay? What did they do? They approved torture. They approved illegal eavesdropping, gross violations of the Fourth Amendment. They were in on the plans for attacking Iraq. These guys, a bunch of thugs. I remember I had a chance to ask Mueller a question. It was at Georgetown University. I wasn't alone. There were about 200 people there. But I asked him, he had just stepped down. I said, now, Director Mueller, I'm wondering if you had any qualms about the legality of parallel construction. Now, for your listeners, parallel construction is where you illegally obtain things through dragnet surveillance of phone calls or emails or whatever, and then you give that to the local police or to the FBI and say, look, you can use this to catch these very bad guys, but whatever you do, don't tell the judge because it's right out of court. Don't tell the defense attorneys either. Now, it's just well established that that's what was going on. So when I had my chance, I said, now, Director Comey, do you have any misgivings about parallel construction? And he looks at me and he says, no misgivings. After 9/11, we were given special authorities. Mm. You know, I didn't have a chance to say, well, how about the Constitution? So there they are. These guys have violated every law known to the Constitution. That's a slight exaggeration. But why are they universally expected, guys? Because they're part of the establishment. And worse still about Comey, people may have seen Comey kind of squirm in the chair when he was testifying before the House Intelligence Committee, and he came up again with respect to the Senate. When did he squirm? Well, he was asked about why the FBI didn't get access to the computers of the Democratic National Committee. Misses the whole thing, you know. This is where the so-called Russian hack with the Cyrillic on it came from. Okay, so here's Comey saying, well, yeah, we should have. I mean, I would have liked to, but we couldn't. We couldn't get access to the DNC computers, and so we had to go. We had to go with this commercial firm, CrowdStrike, a very good firm, mind you, for forensics. Now, I recognize that you really should do forensics with physical access to the machines, but we couldn't do that. That was before the House, before the Senate. Senator Burr asked him the same thing, and Comey said, "No, we couldn't do that." And Burr never says, now, Director Comey, give us a break. Why couldn't you do that? Why didn't you do that? And the answer is, and I ask your listeners to listen carefully here, the answer is because Comey knew full well that it wasn't the Russians that were responsible for that little hack with the Cyrillic on it. It was his pal John Brennan, head of the CIA, that we now know has an incredibly sophisticated and expensive program which allows hacking into computers or servers or whatever, obfuscating, the word used in the original CIA documents, this comes as usual from WikiLeaks, obfuscating who hacked in and leaving little telltale signs like, ooh, in Cyrillic or Arabic or Farsi or Korean or Chinese. Those are the five languages they were working with. So if I had to guess, and I'd put a lot of money on this, it's not the Russians that were responsible for that great hack that CrowdStrike revealed. It was a hack, but it was done by John Brennan, obfuscating the origin of the hack and putting these little. It wasn't only Cyrillic, by the way. It was the first name and patronymic of the first KGB director, Felix Semyonovich for Dzerzhinsky. I mean, hello.
Well, you don't want them to miss the point, do you, right?
No. You want to be pretty obvious about it. So, anyhow, there's a lot going on here. I've never seen it quite as intense, but I think it's even more deranged from Watergate, because at least Watergate, we had a crime. And so it was legitimate to investigate. These are fishing expeditions. And, you know, Trump is not far off. You know, they make a big thing of him saying it was a Russia thing. It was Trump and Russia. Well, yeah, it was. But everybody says, oh, he's admitting that he wanted to call off the investigation. And my read of that is, no, the Russia thing is that all these leaks were happening and all these fake hacks were happening, and no one looked at those. No one investigated real crimes. It's a crime to leak sensitive information, intercept the messages with the Russian embassy. Those are crimes. Why doesn't anybody investigate it? He couldn't get Jim Comey to do that. And after 10 months, he got fed up, in my view, and he said, well, let's get rid of this guy. And the way he did it was crazy, but he did it.
Yeah. We've got just about 1 minute left, Ray. What can we do to persuade our fellow Americans, fellow human beings, that this is nuts? Because people seem to be thoroughly convinced and to believe they've seen evidence, even if they can't name what it is or point to it or show it to you. How do we change this before it's too late?
Well, you're right. You know, Martin King said there is such a thing as too late. We're getting close to that now, David. The thing is to spread the word around. You're doing a good job. Others are. There are enough of us. What we need to do is persuade the American people. Number one, we need to tell them that before the attack, the war of aggression on Iraq, 69% of them had been misled to believe that Iraq was a threat. Now you know what the number is. 68% of the people believe that Russia has inordinate influence over Donald Trump. We have to disabuse our colleagues of that, make sure they can make cogent decisions, and get them to look at responsible websites.
Thank you for your help in that matter. I wish we could go on. We'll do the other hour and a half in future shows. Ray McGovern, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're most welcome, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, AP reports hundreds of Iraqi civilians fleeing Mosul's old city, climbing over rubble as explosions rock the streets while government forces battle the Islamic State. Cameroonian officials deny UN reports they've driven out at least 5,000 Nigerian refugees in recent weeks, rounding them up in trucks, often separating parents and children, taking them back to the danger they thought they'd escaped. Suicides are up alarmingly among Myanmar refugees in a camp in Thailand. Meanwhile, Austrian defense officials say they'll use armored vehicles and troops to keep migrants from crossing the border from Italy. Displaced people aren't one story. There are 65.9 million, according to the UN Refugee Agency. But it's not just a story about individuals. What's the connection between displacement and the so-called war on terror? Climate disruption. Poverty. On displacement, if you aren't telling the big interconnected story, you aren't telling the story. Vijay Prashad is professor of international studies at Trinity College in Connecticut. He's the author of, most recently, The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution, along with many other books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. His columns appear weekly on Alternet. The most recent carries the arresting headline, "By 2100, refugees would be the most populous country on Earth." We'll talk about displacement and displaced people with Vijay Prashad on this week's Counterspin. And that's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. You may or may not have noticed the correction in the New York Times July 5th. It was generated, FAIR analyst Adam Johnson explains, by a story on the federal government's efforts to seize a Midtown Manhattan skyscraper it says is controlled by Iran. The June 29th article originally read, quote, "The government has agreed to distribute proceeds from the building's sale, which could bring as much as $1 billion, to the families of victims of Iranian-sponsored terrorist attacks, including the September 11th attacks," close quote. That September 11th was an Iranian-sponsored terrorist attack is a spectacular claim, one that would radically alter the official understanding of history. Just casually thrown into an article by the New York Times. In fact, it isn't even something that the lawsuit alleged. The case in question was a class action suit for families of all terrorism victims. And since Iran is designated a state sponsor of terrorism, they were held generically responsible. The U.S. State Department maintains that Iran sponsors terrorism chiefly because of its support for militant groups like Hezbollah, whose attacks are mainly directed at other combatants. But even if this had been what the lawsuit was alleging, it's remarkable that the New York Times simply took the fact. No alleged, no lawsuit claims. Iran's guilt was simply asserted. And that assertion stood for a week until someone evidently got word about how it was grossly wrong. Here's the correction. Quote, "An article on Friday about a jury's decision to let the federal government seize a Midtown Manhattan skyscraper it says is controlled by Iran overstated Iran's responsibility for the September 11th attacks. While a federal court found that Iran had some culpability for the September 11th attacks as a state sponsor of terrorism, it has not been established that Iran sponsored the attacks, which were planned and executed by al-Qaeda." A similar error occurred in a September 25, 2013 article in the Times. Close quote. So, literally parenthetically, the Times notes that the week that it took to correct this massive error was nothing compared to the close to 4 years it took to fix the very same error that the paper made in September 2013. Long overdue, the corrections still minimize the defamation of the original articles, conceding only that it has not been established that Iran sponsored the attacks. Well, yes, it has also not been established that Israel or Saudi Arabia or the Bush administration sponsored the September 11th attacks. But imagine the New York Times framing allegations against those actors in this way. What Adam Johnson calls the North Korea law of journalism, which states that editorial standards are inversely proportional to a country's enemy status, means that the Times can casually smear Iran as sponsoring the deadliest act of terror on U.S. soil, and it's not taken seriously by anyone. Just thrown into an article, forgotten about, and only corrected, with no special note by the paper, almost 4 years later. One might be curious what the New York Times public editor would say about such a glaring error, but the paper eliminated that position a month ago. And finally, in the past few years, the Democratic Party's rank and file have shifted left on major issues, from health care to legalization of drugs to taxes. The heart of the party has grown more progressive. 47% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents now identify as both socially liberal and economically moderate or liberal. That's up from 39% in 2008 and 30% in 2001. In contrast, nominally liberal media, or major media whose editorial line is reliably pro-democratic, have drifted rightward. Just last week, MSNBC announced it had hired torture-supporting, climate-denying, anti-Arab racist Bret Stephens, a recent hire at the New York Times opinion page. The pickup continues a conservative hiring spree at MSNBC, including former George Bush advisor Nicole Wallace, right-wing radio host Hugh Hewitt, old-school conservative Washington Post columnist George Will, and former Fox News stars Greta Van Susteren and Megyn Kelly. Though Van Susteren's show has already been canceled due to low ratings. It just seems worth pointing out, given what we hear about how media are all about the clicks or the views, that a major network would not jump at the chance to have at least one token leftist appeal to an underserved demographic, but instead go in the other direction, hiring more right-wingers without any apparent marketing reason to do so. You'd almost have to conclude that MSNBC and the New York Times are not veering right despite Democratic voters' increasing embrace of leftist policies. They're doing so because of that. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In scale and complexity, the crisis of the world's displaced, 65.9 million people, according to the UN Refugee Agency, is difficult to grasp. The need for a public reckoning, a working through of a societal response to this unprecedented circumstance is clear. And there's little doubt that a room full of media producers would agree that the issue was newsworthy. Pressed, they might say something about how they wished they had more time to devote to such important fare. Except that there seems to be room for several stories saying, for example, there are no new developments on White House-Russia ties, but here's a rehash of previous reports. The serious reporting that does exist often presents refugees as the problem, rather than displacement and its drivers, leaving you to wonder how much media help, not just in the fight to ensure that people's humanity is respected, whatever their status, but the effort to understand the roots of this global phenomenon and address it in a humane way. Vijay Prashad is professor of international studies at Trinity College in Connecticut. His most recent book is The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. He's author of many others, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. His columns appear on Alternet every Wednesday. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Vijay Prashad.
Yeah, thanks, Janine.
Well, the scale of displacement around the world, including within countries, is at new levels, and you've just written about this. Can you give us first just some sense of the scope of things today, and then what you've learned about the number one driver behind displacement?
The UN Refugee Agency has said that the number of the world's displaced, those who are both internally displaced and displaced out of their countries, is about 66 million. This is a very high number, but it should come with a caveat, namely that this is also an approximation. It is my feeling that the number is quite deflated. Very large numbers of people don't come into the statistics that the UN Refugee Agency collects. But nonetheless, this is a very illustrative number. When I looked at it, I decided to see how this number compares with populations. And it turns out that the 66 million refugees in the world would comprise the 21st largest state among the 190-odd states we have in the world. It's a very large number of people. So this scandal should awaken the humanity of people. I'd just like to say that before we talk about the number one driver of refugees, it might be interesting to think about how refugees are reported in the media. And it's my sense that, you know, if refugees inconvenience people in the West, you know, if they come to Western countries seeking asylum or seeking refugee protection, then there are stories written about them. But even that is not often about why people leave their homeland. It's more about the inconvenience caused by them to people in the West, which is why the question of Syria is so important here. Syrian refugees have been coming into Europe, and that flood of refugees has indeed raised the question of refugees in the Western imagination. Now, from Libya, there have been fewer refugees. This doesn't mean that the war against Libya was any less destructive than the war in Syria. But the density of population in Syria is far greater than the density of population in Libya, which means that when a war strikes a city or a town in Syria, people live much more densely, and therefore the impact of the war is felt by civilians, so they flee. In Libya, where the density of population is much lower, people have been moving inside the country, protecting themselves as best as they can. But they haven't been fleeing from Libya as Libyans into Europe. And so Libya is off the agenda. So too South Sudan, from where refugees have been fleeing into Uganda, not to the United States and not to Europe. So there's a way in which the refugee crisis gets portrayed in the Western media that I think is an additional source of concern, which is that it is driven by the inconvenience of Western citizens rather than the actual story of the refugees themselves. And this is something that I think people need to be aware of. We don't get to hear the stories of why people leave, because it seems as if the public in the West is more invested in how to deal with the refugees than what their lives are about.
That's an excellent point. To the extent that the story is presented as an interconnected, as a global story, it's presented as how will certain countries be able to absorb refugees? And it's there's also a kind of a distancing from the humanity of the people who are refugees that I think interferes with people's understanding. You know, we're encouraged to think, well, I would never make that choice to put my family in that kind of danger. You know, we're encouraged by a kind of individualistic focus when we really need to be looking at bigger pictures. And so I want to ask you specifically about Libya, because the interconnectedness of things is not something that media encourage us to see. So here is the Los Angeles Times with an explainer on the problems of displacement. And they say, quote, why are migrants headed to Italy? Italy has long been a destination for those hoping to reach European shores because of its proximity to North Africa, specifically the lawless nation of Libya, which in recent years has become a launch pad for Mediterranean crossings, close quote. So this is media's explanation for why migrations are following this particular flow, and it's because Libya is lawless. Well, there's an opportunity to teach readers in the U.S. something there, but the history is missing.
Yes, there are two things here that are very important. One is, yes, Libya is lawless, but why? And that is something that not only the Los Angeles Times, but Western media in general vacates. They don't enter that question. Libya is lawless because a NATO intervention destroyed the state and, in a sense, put Libyan society at great peril. But Libyans, and this is the second point, Libyans themselves are not crossing the Mediterranean in large numbers. Libya has quite correctly become a launch pad, but Libyans are not crossing. And the reason they are not crossing is what I mentioned. In other words, the density of population question, and that they've been able to find, at great social cost to Libyan society, they've been able to find a way to protect themselves. You know, Libya is in great peril, but Libyans have found a way to at least manage this crisis for themselves personally. You know, for a very long period, the economies of Western Africa and Central Africa have been racked by war and by economic policies that have undercut people's ability to make their lives. These are economic policies related to mining, allowing large companies, many of them Western companies, some of them Chinese companies, that have been allowed to open up large mines and displace people. Secondly, there have been agricultural policies, cotton subsidies, for instance, in the United States and Europe, that have impoverished many West African countries and destroyed cotton farming. So they have been displaced. And thirdly, people have had their climate seized from them. As climate change comes into a great focus in West Africa, agriculture has been damaged, and so people have been displaced by that. They've been moving from their countries in West Africa through Gao in Mali and Agadez in Niger up into Libya, and this crossing across the Sahara is very dangerous. There, you know, people are dying every day crossing the Sahara before they get to Libya, but then they are, of course, dying in the Mediterranean. And I'm interested, again, to just point a little finger here. It's come to the media's attention that people are dying in the Mediterranean, but there's been virtually no reporting about how dangerous the Sahara is to cross. This suggests, again, to repeat the point, that when something is right before the eyes of Europe or the United States, it becomes a matter of great interest. When it is slightly far away, it's less a matter of interest. Similarly, with migration into the United States, the Rio Grande is something that people in the United States pay attention to. What they're not paying attention to is the southern Mexican border, where there are also virtually concentration camps set up at the behest of the United States to hold Central American refugees, who are also climate and agricultural policy refugees, trying to move somewhere where they can make a livelihood. And those camps are not being reported on. What's reported on is President Trump's statements about building a wall. So somehow there is a kind of myopia in the Western media in covering the refugee crisis.
And certainly an unwillingness to explore the role of major powers, and particularly the U.S., in creating these circumstances and driving the wars and driving the climate disruption and the extractive policies and the austerity prescriptions that grow misery and that are such powerful forces behind the movement of peoples. Well, I want to talk about response now. You spoke to Paul Spiegel, who's formerly of the UN Refugee Agency, or have a quote from him in your piece in which he said, "The current humanitarian system is not simply overstretched, it is no longer fit for purpose," which you aptly describe as shattering words. What does it mean? What was Paul Spiegel saying?
Well, the current system, namely the UN system and the non-governmental organization system, is set up to deal with a crisis. And by crisis, what is understood is a short-term issue. Let's say there is a war, people flee war. So the UN system and the ancillary non-government organization system kicks in to help people who have fled a war. The understanding is that the war is going to end, and then people can return to their lives. The example of Palestine, of course, is there, that for 60-odd years, people have been displaced. There is no resolution to the conflict, and people have been living as refugees in camps you know, for generations now. So earlier there were one or two incidents where there were a refugee crisis that seemed to go on forever. Now we've reached a situation where there are multiple crises that seem to have no solution. So whether it is, as you say, the austerity crisis, the climate crisis, or wars that seem not to come to resolution, tens of millions of people have become permanent refugees. And it is in the context of this condition of being a permanent refugee that the UN system and the ancillary NGO agencies are simply not capable of dealing with it. You know, they don't have the resources and they don't have the policies in place to deal with a condition where very large numbers of people have become permanent refugees. And I think that's what Spiegel was referring to. And I think it's about time we have a public international conversation about this permanent condition of refugee that looks to be without resolution.
And then speaking to the media piece of it, you've talked about it being also long past time to shift from this security frame, from this idea that if we police people harder, they won't move, to a humanity frame, to a different way, a fundamentally different way of looking at this phenomenon. First of all, not just that it's not temporary, and we have to look at that, but also that it's not about security. It shouldn't be seen through the prism of danger and fear.
Well, you know, it's a basic rational issue that if somebody is doing something, you want to know why are you doing it. If somebody says, I want to come into country X from country Y, I think it's a fairly rational thing to ask, why would you like to do that? And, you know, most people would say, look, I don't want to come to this country, but it's too difficult to live where I'm living. I think that's a very fair conversation to have. If it's too difficult to live where I'm living, that means the solution to the problem is either to make the conditions of flight different, in other words, to make it easier to live where you're living, or to figure out how to rearrange populations if areas of the world are becoming, you know, impossible to live in. If islands are disappearing, then we need to have a concept of climate change refugees. If islands are not disappearing and there's war or there's starvation or that, you know, it's becoming harder to grow cotton, then perhaps it's a good idea to think about, well, how should the global cotton market work? How should cotton farmers be recompensed? These are, it seems to me, rational conversations to have. Instead of having these conversations, the discussion that is there on the table is how best to prevent migrants from entering countries. So the world leadership at the G7, presidents and prime ministers of countries in the West, merely talk about the question of security, terrorism, or building fences, building walls, policing the Mediterranean. In fact, one columnist quite spectacularly in Britain wrote a column saying that it's perhaps useful to shoot refugees to deter them from making the crossing in the Mediterranean. So, you know, this framework of security has become normal. And the framework of humanity has been seen not only as idealistic, but as ridiculous in a way. And I think people need to reconsider that. Is it quite ridiculous to ask people why they want to move? I think it's far more ridiculous to have a conversation about shooting boats in the Mediterranean. But of course, that's not the way things are right now.
In the case of Syria, which is, you know, beyond the beyond, the United States displaces 200,000 Syrians with military action. And then Trump says they should be barred as refugees because they're Trojan horses, you know. And it's not just illogical, it's perverse, you know. You, of course, teach international studies and so are accustomed to a global prism in which you see things on a broader system. I do feel that media are so locked into this nationalistic frame, but that doesn't mean that people are. You know, in a way, there's a different conversation going on among human beings than perhaps among powerful folks.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the question that somebody asks somebody who is in distress is, how can I help you? One would hope that that's the way that scholarship functions That's the way that governments function. But I'm sorry to say that even in the field of international relations, security studies of a very narrow way is beginning to dominate the thinking. But security for whom? I would say that the regime of borders and policing actually makes the conditions for a great deal of abuse to take place. So because the Mediterranean crossing is so fundamentally difficult, and because the Sahara crossing is so difficult, the migrants have to put themselves in the hands of professional human traffickers. And here we see evidence of a great deal of abuse, you know, where somebody puts themselves in the hands of a human trafficker and then becomes trafficked themselves. Sex work, young people sent to labor camps in Libya. I mean, a great deal of abuse has been documented. So the question is security for whom? This security frame, again, is security for the wealthy. It's security for the West. It's not security for the migrant. You know, nobody's thinking about what are the rights of a migrant? What is the security of the migrant? I think that has disappeared from our public conversation. So occasionally there's a scandal. People are scandalized by the fact that somebody who's a refugee is mistreated. But the question isn't that this refugee is mistreated on a one-off way. The entire system is constructed in such a way that abuse is normal. I think that's how we need to understand this. The question of security is not about security in general, but it's security in a very particular way for those who are powerful and those who have means.
We've been speaking with Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Connecticut's Trinity College and author of Uncle Swami, South Asians in America Today, and the award-winning The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. You can find his weekly columns on alternet.org. Vijay Prashad, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
not just the stock market this morning, but it's also the deadly heat wave that has people worried today. Triple-digit temperatures still scorching wide areas of the country.
Americans don't die of the heat. They just turn on their air conditioners.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
Over 50 Americans died from the heat last week, and more than 40 in floods.
Endeavour is heading back to Earth with the astronauts marveling at a storm so massive it now blankets the Earth below.
EcoShock.
Triggering mudslides and washing away roads and bridges, forcing evacuations.
In the Houston area, people are stocking up and boarding up, just in case Dean takes a sudden swing north.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing.
Back in the 60s when Bob Dylan sang that song, a wave of people stepped outside the script of society. This is Alex Smith telling you, there is a whole new movement happening. I've seen it with my own eyes, recorded it with my electronic ears. Last week in Vancouver, the hall under the planetarium was filled for the Climate Roadshow. The next night, another crowd gathered for the advanced screening of DiCaprio's new film, The 11th Hour. Night after that, over 400 people filled an obscure church to talk about the coming energy crisis. They left the television, the condo, the mall, the prefab entertainment to talk with one another, to find out what to do. This underground movement has gone mainstream, and it's bubbling up all over the world. It isn't in the newspapers or on TV. It's in cafes, cheap halls, and living rooms. People are talking. What will they do as government ceases to represent their concerns? In fact, as the government proves itself unable to act, incompetent in the face of humanity's greatest challenges. Today we'll listen in to the Climate Change Despair and Empowerment Roadshow. Australian activist Kelly Tudhope is a graduate of law and social sciences. Following the mandate of Al Gore to reach out to real people at the grassroots, she is on a whirlwind tour of North America, accompanied by longtime Washington State activist Pat Rasmussen. Pat Rasmussen of the World Temperate Rainforest Network also spoke on the impacts of global warming on temperate rainforests, and that's an important talk that will run later in this season. This session was organized by the Western Canada's Wilderness Group. Their executive director, Andrea Reimer, went to Al Gore's climate camp, came back swearing to pass on the message to at least 1,000 people, and kept her promise. But now Tudhope, jet-lagged from 24 hours of flying from Australia, where the climate has dried up to drought, takes the stage, as she will night after night. She goes from Vancouver all down the West Coast, stopping in at cities and towns, staying with supporters, to San Francisco, and then to Hawaii. In every room, the old hippies are flooded out by a new generation, the young people who inherited the wind and the heat from their carboniferous parents. Perhaps Tudhope won't reach forest activist, now climate activist, John Seed's record of 36 speeches in 40 nights. Or maybe she will. It's a multimedia presentation with clips from Ross Gelbspan, Al Gore, and, well, a talking wombat. Partway through, Tudhope gets people talking to one another. And afterwards, a man explains his electric pickup truck running on batteries the people threw away. Another tells of stolen rivers. A former city councillor announces a series of climate cafes coming up. Email addresses and online discussion groups fly about. The buzz is there, and it's spreading. Something big is waking up, without any advertising. No corporate sponsors, no spin doctors. I believe it could be the start of the people taking charge of their destiny. The wall is falling. Let's go on the Climate Roadshow, ready for despair and empowerment. Looking back, almost wistfully, this is Radio EcoShock from August 7, 2007, 10 years ago, when our chances looked better.
And now Kelly Tudhope from Australia and New Zealand.
So as Fred kindly pointed out, apparently I've got an accent and I've never heard it, but please let me know if you have trouble understanding me and I'll slow down or try and enunciate a bit better. Am I doing all right so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So Fred kindly introduced me and gave my background. I've been doing this presentation since the beginning of the year when I was inspired to do so when I saw John Seed speak close to where I live in a place called Ballingen. And he asked whether or not there's anyone in the audience that was willing to get on their feet and spread the message further. And so that's how I came to do this. This is about my 25th presentation to date, and I've just finished the Northern Queensland leg of this tour, which involved about 10 presentations in 8 days. From here, this presentation goes through Washington State to Oregon, California, and then to Hawaii until I return home on the 14th of September. To date, this presentation has been given well over 100 times in Australia, including northern New South Wales, the Sunshine Coast, Sydney, Melbourne, northern Queensland, and down the east coast of America by John Seed just recently, who did 36 presentations in 40 days, which is a bit more than I was keen to take on, but well done to John. So, obviously, I'm not a climatologist. I come here, while I've got a social science background and a background in law, my reason for doing so is really brought about by my belief in a philosophy of a man called Aldo Leopold. And what he teaches is that all of us are plain members and citizens of the biotic community. And so that's what I'm here. I stand before you as a plain, concerned and pregnant member of the biotic community who's concerned not just for my own and my new family's welfare, but for every person here and future generations and every species on this planet. So I'm no expert on climate change, but we've got at least one expert on our team at the Rainforest Information Centre, and his name is Ross Galspan. And I don't know if you know of Ross Galspan, but Ross is a journalist who has been reporting for many of the major newspapers in the US, and most recently the Boston Globe, for which he most recently won the Pulitzer Prize for his investigative journalism. Ross says that he came to the issue of climate change not as an environmentalist. He didn't even like trees, he merely tolerated them. But what brought Ross to act on this issue was that he learnt more than 10 years ago that companies like ExxonMobil and other oil companies had been paying scientists under the table to muddy the waters on climate change and make it appear that there was more scientific controversy over the existence of global warming than there actually was. A recent scientific review of scientific literature showed that out of the 950 randomly chosen scientific peer-reviewed documents, that exactly zero of those articles cast any doubt as to whether or not climate change was actually happening. A review for the same time period of major newspaper articles of what they were saying found that over 50% of the articles included some climate scepticism in them. And so this indicates the success of those oil companies. And as a result, it has cost us as a species and both in states and communities and countries 10 very important years in our ability to engage in effective and sustainable action with regards to climate change. So Ross Galspan, in a address called Boiling Point, and he actually has written a book called Boiling Point, has something to say on climate change that I'm going to share with you now.
Unintentionally, we have set in motion massive systems of the planet with huge amounts of inertia that have kept this Earth hospitable for 10,000 years. We have heated the deep oceans, We have loosed a wave of violent weather. We've altered the timing of the seasons. We're living on an increasingly narrow margin of stability, and the evidence is all around us. From my perspective, the climate crisis clusters together three dimensions: its natural dimension, its energy dimension, and its economic dimension. Its natural dimension is truly of cosmic proportion. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere traps in heat. For 10,000 years, we had the same amount, 280 parts per million, until about 150 years ago when the world began to industrialize. That 280 is now up to 379. That is a level this planet has not experienced for at least 420,000 years. Unchecked, that will double later in this century to 560, and that correlates with an increase in the average global temperature of 3 to 10 degrees. And for context, the last ice age was only 5 to 9 degrees colder than our current climate. Each year, we're putting about 7 billion tons of carbon into an atmosphere whose upper extent is about 10 miles overhead. Its second dimension, which is its energy dimension, is really staggering to contemplate. Basically, to allow the climate to restabilize requires nothing less than rewiring the entire globe and replacing every oil-burning furnace, every coal-burning generating plant, every gasoline-burning car with climate-friendly and renewable energy sources. The U.S. spends more than $20 billion a year subsidizing coal and oil. The industrial countries spend about $200 billion a year doing that. We're saying that in the industrial countries, take those subsidies away from fossil fuels, put them behind renewables. The oil companies will follow the subsidies and become aggressive developers of fuel cells and solar panels and windmills. As one Argentine climate negotiator said, we are all in the same boat, and there's no way half the boat is going to sink.
So I'd just like to update a couple of those facts, because that was filmed a couple of years ago now. So the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is now at a level that has not been seen in 650,000 years. And for your information, in Australia, our subsidies of the fossil fuel industry are between the figure of $6.5 billion and $9 billion a year. And so it's significant. I think at the worldwide level, it's in the subsidisation of fossil fuels is in the region of $350 billion. You know, and some people might say, why are we subsidising ourselves, our own destruction? It seems pretty silly, I think. So, as Andrea mentioned, probably the person that's done the most to bring about public awareness on the issue of global warming is Al Gore. And he's been going around for the last 30 years raising public awareness, and he started off with a slideshow presentation that became a PowerPoint presentation that became an Inconvenient Truth. And I'm guessing, have most people here seen an Inconvenient Truth?
Yes.
Yes, yes. And so if you haven't seen it on DVD, I do recommend that you get the DVD out, because there's a really good section in the special features where Al Gore does did an update for 12 months later and goes into things like population growth that weren't covered in the original movie. So Al Gore came to Australia last year. His primary reason was to train climate messengers, and he said that although the issue of climate change is rising to prominence everywhere in the world, nowhere more so is it nowhere more so than in Australia. And many of us laughed because we thought he was just being a typical politician and he was trying to butter us up. But then we started looking around at the facts, and we discovered that an opinion poll taken recently after that interview said that 93% of Australians were concerned about climate change. And we started wondering when the last time 93% of Australians agreed about anything, but I don't know if it's the same here in Vancouver. So he trained, Al Gore came and he trained 85 climate messengers in Australia last year, and 1,700 people applied for those positions, which shows that people actually really want to get engaged in this issue. In fact, so many people in Australia want to get involved that now Al Gore's coming back in September to train about another 120 or so people to give his a local version of An Inconvenient Truth. It's not surprising that people are really concerned in Australia, because I'm not sure if anybody here has been to Australia recently, but it's pretty evident that our climate's changing. We are in the worst drought, I think, that Australia's probably seen in memory. In Brisbane, we've got really, really draconian water restrictions to the likes of that you wouldn't even think of. And so in Australia, in Brisbane, you can read on the council's website that the only way that you can wash your car is to use the dew that forms there in the morning. And so this is how little water we have in Australia. Not all of it's in drought, of course. I've chosen to live in a place that isn't in drought, but certainly most of the country is. Even our food is becoming, the food production is becoming questionable. In the Murray-Darling Basin, which is one of Australia's main food-producing regions, there has been serious concerns about the ability of to meet water irrigation requirements, and there was some concern at the beginning of the year that they would actually cut irrigation requirements totally. Our Prime Minister, John Howard's response to this was that Australians should pray for rain. The Rainforest Information Centre thinks that there's some other things that we can do other than pray for rain, even though I'm not dismissing the importance of prayer. And so what this presentation is about is not so much whether or not climate change exists. I take that as a given fact. I think we're now at the point that we can move beyond questioning whether or not the science behind climate change is sound or not. I think that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the number of scientists involved and the credibility due to its peer-reviewed nature establishes beyond doubt that we are experiencing climate change, and now we need to look at solutions. So this presentation primarily looks at why and what stops us from effectively challenging the status quo and from moving into a sustainable future and adopting technologies and solutions that will help us get there. When Al Gore was in Australia, he was interviewed by Denton on ABC TV, and I'd like to share with you what he said.
To me, this is so compelling. I think it's the challenge of our lifetimes, and our lifetimes represent the period when the human species will make fateful decisions that will determine the future of human civilization. Now, as to the paralyzing effect of seeing these consequences, that's a real danger. And there are people who go, as I say in the movie, from denial to despair without pausing on the intermediate step. And what denial and despair have in common is they both let you off the hook. You don't have to do anything. And actually, the mature approach is that all of us have to take, we have to find our way to it, is to act to solve this. And we can solve it. Despair is completely unjustified. I continued to advocate bold changes, but ran into that brick wall of resistance. And one of the lessons I learned was the need to go to the grassroots level. I don't know if you have that phrase here. And to go to people one by one, community by community, and engage in a fairly massive and sustained effort to try to change the minds of people about this crisis.
So I think Al Gore's done a really, really fantastic job, and I have no qualms about what he's done. He's just brought this issue really into the public eye. Especially in the last year, I think the amount of awareness on this issue has risen, maybe beyond what people originally thought was possible in such a short period of time. But nonetheless, I'm going to humbly disagree with a few things that Al Gore just said. And the first thing I'm going to disagree with is the way that he characterises despair. He says that we have everything that we need to solve this crisis, and therefore despair is completely unjustified. I agree. I think that we do actually have everything we need to solve this crisis. I think that we are an extremely intelligent species that can rise to this occasion if we so choose. But I don't think it actually follows that we are going to do what needs to be done. You know, 93% of Australians say they are concerned about climate change, but no one or very few people are actually doing anything about it. And neither is our government. Our government is probably doing less than those 93% of citizens that are concerned about climate change. It's doing very little at all to bring about changes, and we only hear two things come from our government's lips, and that is carbon sequestration, which I believe is not actually such a big technological option in Vancouver, but it is in Australia, and nuclear. So rather than look at all of the options that we could have in Australia, the government is focusing on these two only, regardless of all the issues and the problems associated with these technologies. I also think that the fear in this situation is completely justified. If we look around, we come to see that we are in the sixth mass extinction period ever to face life on Earth in the 4,500 million years that life has existed here. It's only happened five times before in the whole life of this planet, or the whole period of life on this planet. Scientists tell us that last year 30,000 species became extinct, and that this year 30,000 more species are going to become extinct. And this is going to continue unless we really adopt meaningful solutions to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Predictions say that if the temperature increases above this magical number of 2 degrees, then we are in serious problem. We have a serious problem. 2 degrees is known as a tipping point, whereby after which we get runaway climate change that is taken out of the hands of humanity to curb. We've already experienced a 3/4 degree rise across the globe, degree Celsius rise across the globe in our temperature, and we are set for a further 3/4 degree rise by the emissions or the greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere due to the lag period between which the emissions are released and the greenhouse gas effect. And so we actually don't have very much to play with. So once again, I think that this makes despair completely justified. But the reason I think that Al Gore says that despair is completely unjustified is because of the way that he sees despair. You know, coming from a Western culture, we are taught that every one of our negative emotions is something to suppress and to hold down, because the last thing we want to do is to express them. And so despair and other negative emotions like anger and fear has become seen like as a dead end. And once we get there and experience these feelings, oh, woe is me, and all is lost because there's no way out. And it becomes a quagmire and an excuse for non-action. You know, but there's another way to see despair, luckily, and this is what deep ecology, which is the framework that John Seed has developed with a lady called Joanna Macy over the years. And it teaches that we can move through our feelings of fear or anguish or despair, into a position of empowerment, and that if we can sit with these feelings and move through them, then underneath them is the golden nugget or the golden seed or the silver lining in the cloud that we need to find to move into a position of empowerment. And indeed, the only thing that we really need to do to move into this position of empowerment and passion is to release these emotions by expressing them with people that are invited to honestly discuss them. And so I'd like just give you an analogy. Like, you have a bottle of fizzy drink and you can shake it up, and it's like these emotions. The emotions are like these, the fizz in the drink. And every time that we learn more and more about our environment and climate change, species loss, pollution, it's like the bottle continues to be, we continue to shake the bottle and this pressure builds up. And the last thing we want to do is to release those emotions from the bottle. And so we use a lot of energy to keep that cork in the bottle, because the last thing that we want to do is to release them. This energy that we use to hold down that cork in the bottle is part of the energy that we can use to find the passion and the motivation that we need to bring about effective action and on this issue of climate change. You know, when we have these feelings of hopelessness and despair, and we can come to think that, oh well, you know, all is lost, that it's all hopeless, and you know, I'm only one person and the issue is so big that what can I do? And you know, it sort of lets us off the hook. And when we have these feelings, that we sort of feel quite justified and sort of alright, because we've been let off the hook. But we need to move beneath these feelings to find this empowerment. And so what usually happens when we do these presentations is that a workshop is follows it around, and this despair and empowerment workshop invites people that participate in the presentation to actually come and experience the truth of what we're saying, or like what I'm saying here tonight. And unfortunately, it hasn't happened in Vancouver just because of how my schedule has worked out. But if people are interested in actually experiencing this, and I do recommend it's a fantastic opportunity to get to know your own feelings and also to get to experience the truth of how other people feel. You know, we can feel quite isolated and in our emotions towards the environment, and a lot of people don't really talk to each other. You can go out to a party or something and people will say, you know, how are you today? And, oh yeah, all's good. It's certainly not the right answer to say, oh well, I'm really in despair because 30,000 species died last year. And so we've got this conditioning about how to respond, and so if we can overcome this and express our feelings in a room full of people, then it's an amazing experience that brings the empowerment that we need to act on this issue. You know, our ancestors, especially our pre-human ancestors, made intelligent enough decisions that every single one of our ancestors reached an age of reproduction before they were consumed. And they did this before they grew this big bulge over their head that helped them to make logical decisions. And I think what we actually need to tap into our feeling function in order to find this passion and this motivation to act on this issue. You can just think of two examples. When you're on the edge of a cliff, the thing that stops you from stepping over the edge of the cliff is the fear that you're going to fall. Or when you're looking at a shark in the water, the reason that you don't pat that shark is because of the fear that it might eat you. And so these feelings that we have are really intelligent if we choose to listen to them. And I think that if we did choose to listen to them in the past, that we probably wouldn't be in the situation that we are now in. So I'd like to invite people here to begin to experience the truth of what I just said, and feel free to bow out of this if you want. It only takes, what, a minute or so, but I'd just like to invite people here to like turn to your neighbours and just to say whether or not you think what I say is true, or whether or not you've had any of these feelings that I'm talking about. And I'd like you to do that now.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. We'll return to Kelly Tudhope and the Climate Change, Despair, and Empowerment Roadshow after this quick break. You are tuned to the Radio EcoShock Show with me, Alex Smith. I have a one-minute message from Arnie the Ape, and then we'll get right back to Kelly Tudhope at the Vancouver Planetarium on August 15th, 2007.
Hi, my name is Waru. I'm an orangutan. I used to be a bodybuilder, but now I've become the carbonator, and I have an environmental message for your ace. Here in our forest, we have a problem with predators. They are palm oil companies who are burning down our rainforest to plant palm oil trees. What for? Palm oil for your cookies and your shampoo and your fried chicken. 5,000 orangutans like me are being killed every year. My men are not expendable. We are going extinct down here, and if we do, we won't be back. You know what else? The forest fires are causing climate change by filling the atmosphere with carbon. It's a catastrophe. Soon they won't even let me drive my Hummer. Join me and be a real action hero. Take action by demanding that companies only use sustainable palm oil and make them put it on the label. Do it. Do it now, or I'll kick your ass.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This Radio EcoShock show was broadcast August 7, 2007. Now to Kelly Tudhope and the Climate Change Roadshow.
So everybody, I find that when we do this exercise, everybody gets really excited, and we usually have a wombat, a dancing wombat that I usually show you, but he's having a little sleep at the moment, so I'm just going to carry on, and he'll be back in a minute. So the wombat's going to tell you about something really, really important, and well, actually, first off, it could be a beaver, but there's a bit of controversy over whether he's a wombat or a beaver, and you'll see why. So what the wombat slash beaver wants to talk to you about is the importance of recognising the interconnectedness of all forms of life. And this is really, really fundamental to any solutions that we adopt with regards to climate change. And it's said that if any solution that we adopt is to be meaningful and lasting, then it has to be accompanied by a complementary value system. You know, what we're taught in our Western society, and many of you may not even be aware of this, but what we're taught is that life is fragmented, that it is sort of like dots that aren't actually related to each other, and so these dots aren't connected. And that also that our life, every form of life by human beings, has no value in and of itself, and that it's only valuable because humans give it value. These are two, this is known as instrumentalism or materialism and reductionism, and these are two fundamental philosophical beliefs of our Western society that it is said must change. And we need to change, I believe, to one of a value structure that is holistic, that sees that life is interconnected and valuable. And you know, the experience that you just shared with each other really shows the truth of the interconnectedness of life, because if we weren't all part of this earth, then there's no right way that we'd feel despair for the creatures on the earth. And so when we can actually find the courage that we need to experience our feelings of despair or hopelessness or fear, then what we can actually do is move beyond them and find that the reason that we feel despair is because it actually is a reflection of our compassion for all forms of life. And that we feel this compassion because, in truth, we are interconnected. And so I think if we can consider this and see the truth in it, then we will definitely take the steps we need to heal this world. And the beaver's back, so I'll let him finish what I was going to say.
Yo, listen up. This is your home. It's the only one you got. This place is pretty, but you can't live there. You can't even get there. So I repeat, this is your home. It's the only one you got. Cherish it, protect it. It's the only one you're going to get. These guys, they're your neighbors. They ain't going away. They ain't leaving. You have to get along with them. So you have to learn to share. You have to get along. You have to learn to get along. Because they are your neighbors. They're not going away. Okay, all this stuff, the animals, the waters, the sky, the ground, the bugs, the fish, the tacos, the people, they're all connected. Everything is connected. They all depend on one another. If you ignore that, you're doomed. Repeat, doomed, okay? So listen up. It's all one. Not two worlds, not three, one. Just one. So get it in gear. Remember, all is one, okay? Hit it.
I thought you'd like him. He's pretty good. So the wombat actually comes free. You can take him home. He's downloadable from that site just up there. So if you want a take-home version, just write down that and you can download him for free. So I'd like to talk a bit about solutions, about what we can do to bring about the necessary changes in our life and our lifestyles to combat this really serious issue of climate change. I'd like to start by saying that I don't actually think that any person knows what the solution is at the moment. I think that there are lots of potential solutions, but they're sort of like pieces of the jigsaw puzzle that we don't quite know how to fit together. And so I think that we really need to look into it individually and collectively to decide what is the best route and methods to take. I don't think there's one solution. I think there's many solutions, and we just need to work out into what quantities and what mix we want to make that happen. So I mentioned before that in Australia there's two solutions, or so-called solutions, that we hear from our government's lips, and they are nuclear and clean coal, or carbon sequestration. I don't actually think that either of these solutions or either of these technologies are solutions at all to the issue of climate change. I think that they are solutions to
the political and industrial problem of how to keep business as usual running in the face of a public that is increasingly concerned about climate change. I don't think so. That's what I think those solutions are for. You know, in the last 12 months in the USA, the amount of people that have said that they think that climate change is the number one environmental issue facing the world has doubled, and it's going to continue to double as awareness is raised. So politicians and industrialists have a serious problem on their hands, and so this is why we hear solutions like that. I believe in Canada, nuclear is not an issue. No? It is an issue, so it's not as clear-cut. They haven't thrown that out. Okay, so well, I'll talk briefly on nuclear then. You know, it's touted as this clean, green technology, and that the electricity is produced, electricity produced by nuclear does not produce carbon dioxide. And, yeah, okay, that's true, but you need to look at how the electricity is made, and then you find out that it's not this clean, green technology. An average-sized nuclear power plant emits between 376,000 tonnes and 1.2 million tonnes of carbon dioxide a year. This amount will go up as the quality of the uranium declines, and given that there's only between 50 to 100 years of uranium in the world, it's the sustainability of nuclear as a power generation option is seriously questionable. In Australia, and I believe here in Canada, one of the other solutions that we commonly hear by our governments is this is changing our light bulbs. Is this correct? Yeah. Okay, so I don't know how long you guys have got to change your light bulbs, but in Australia we've got 2 to 3 years to change all our incandescent bulbs to these new fluorescent varieties. And mercury. Oh, yeah, there's an issue with mercury, which is toxic waste, so you can't throw them away for sure. So for the government didn't tell you about that. But in Australia, they also didn't tell you that what the amount of electricity that you're going to save is pretty small. In fact, it's only 0.14% of electricity generated, and that saving is going to be gobbled up in 14 days at predicted electricity growth rates. And so it's sort of really insignificant, and from the point of view of reducing our carbon emissions, I think it's good because it helps, when people do this, it helps bring our integrity and our intention to do something in line with our actions. But in and of itself, I don't think changing its light bulbs is going to do much. And I find it really interesting that there's a joke to this effect. Do you guys know this joke? How many people does it take to change a light bulb? Anyway. So the other thing that we hear is, as a potential solution, is biodiesel or biofuel. And the Dutch government got a head start on the rest of the world 10 years ago and said that its diesel had to contain 10% of palm oil in its composition to reduce emissions. And it looked like this really good idea, but as demand increased, so did the environmental degradation associated with the growth of the palm oil industry. In Borneo, it is especially problematic because the forests, the swamp forests, are clear felled to make way for these palm oil plantations. And swamp forests hold like 30 times... Oh, no, hang on. Swamp forests hold a lot more carbon in them than do normal forests because of the way that they decompose when the trees die. When they decompose, the trees actually turn to peat. And so when they clear fell and burn those forests, not only do they release the carbon that's contained in the trees, but they also release the carbon that's in the peat soil. In its whole lifetime, a palm oil plantation will never ever sequester the amount of carbon dioxide that is released into the atmosphere through that process. And so it's a very, very serious problem that we're facing. A study by Friends of the Earth, I believe, showed that between the years of 1985 and 2000, 87% of deforestation in Malaysia was a direct result of palm oil plantations. Unfortunately, the USA is about to engage in a similar operation in the Amazon by creating sugar plantations to produce ethanol, and so there's another risk on that front. So it's not just about palm oil, it's also about these so-called sustainable crops, which also threaten food security because there's now competition between crops to produce food and crops to produce oil, which is something we really need to think about when we adopt changes in our fuel production methods. So I think that we're in a bit of a dangerous situation because a lot of people and a lot of industrialists are going around grasping at solutions and solutions that aren't actually thought through about their economic and their social and their environmental costs. And I think because of this, every person that is capable really needs to start looking at the issue and at the solutions about what they can do. But one thing is for sure is that the solutions that to solve our climate crisis will not come from government and they will not come from industrialists. There is only one place that they can come from and it is with the people, and it starts right here with the people in this room and everywhere else. I also don't think that the solution should come from anywhere else. I think that this problem is so big and has such far-reaching consequences that everybody that is of moral capacity actually needs to look at the solution and to think, what can I do and what should I do in this circumstance? I don't think we should leave it to a handful of often invested interests to come to the determination of where our planet should go and where our species on this planet should go and if they should survive or not. I think it's up to us. So a lot of people think that in order to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions means that we've got to go back into the Stone Age, and people don't want to do that, so, you know, that's another way to get off the hook. But, you know, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, and I'm just going to tell you about a couple of things that we can eat, I guess. And the first thing is that in the United States, and I'm sure this probably correlates to Canada as well, is that if the speed limit was reduced from 70 to 50 miles an hour, it would save 1 billion barrels of oil a year, which is actually roughly what the US imports from the Middle East. So you can do the math on that one. In Australia, that correlates to about 89 Ks. You can slow down. It's a little bit dangerous to do that yourselves. This is not just an individual action. You know, people get quite angry if you slow down and hold them up. So to bring about this sort of change would require a collective action. And it also requires the relevant knowledge, because can you imagine what it would be like if somebody ran for parliament that said, if you vote me in, I'm going to reduce the speed limit by 20 miles an hour. They'd have absolutely no hope of getting in. And so we need to have the education as well on this issue. Pat opened tonight with a discussion on rainforests, and temperate rainforests in particular, and it really leads to a very important point. What we need to really do on this issue is to stop illegal logging and also diebacks of forests. In Australia, we've come up with an initiative to help with logging, and it's called the Global Initiative on Forest and Climate, and the Australian government is giving $200 million to to this fund to monitor forest cover, to show where people are illegally logging, and part of that fund is going to the Indonesians to stop or help them to control illegal logging. At the same time, it is prepared to allow for Tasmania's old-growth forest to be logged. And so there's a little bit of inconsistency with what it's preaching and what it's practicing. But it's really key to make sure that we can stop clear-felling forests, because forests contribute to 25% of the carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere. And so if we can do that, we're going to take big steps towards combating climate change. So there's lots of things that we can do as individuals, and I'm sure many of you here are beginning to be aware of what you can do at the individual level, yeah? Yes? Yeah? One of the biggest things that we can do is to look at what we eat. And what I'm about to say as an offer is for your information, and so I'm not telling you what to eat, because people get a little bit upset when I do that. So I'd just like to say that if you chose to eat locally produced food, and I believe there's a couple of farmers markets in Vancouver, yeah? So if you eat locally produced food, then you certainly reduce your food miles. And it's about the average piece of food moves about 1,600 miles between where it's produced and where it's consumed. So if we can do that and choose locally produced food, then we certainly will reduce our carbon footprint. The other thing that we can do is reduce the amount of meat that we eat. In Australia, and I know it's significantly less here in Canada, but in Australia, the amount of methane and agricultural gases released equates to 18% of our greenhouse gas emissions, and that's actually higher than stationary energy and transport in Australia. So we can really do a lot if we can stop methane from cows and sheep being emitted. And we can only do this if individuals choose to reduce or stop consuming meat and dairy products. The other really big way that we can reduce our emissions is by eating organically. And obviously this is one of my areas of interest given my 7-year activism in genetic engineering. But you see, there was a study produced in the United States that showed that if 320 farms of 10,000 acres each in the United States converted to organic, then, get this figure right, 1 million, it'll be equivalent to 1,174,000 cars being taken off the road. And so that's really, really significant. So I know that organic costs or can cost a bit more, but the more demand goes up, then the cost will certainly come down. So Al Gore was in the United Kingdom a while back, and he did an interview with Channel 4 there, and I'd like to share what he said, because in typical political fashion, he managed to say the same thing no matter what question was asked. And I'm not going to share the whole 40 minutes, but I've just got a couple of minutes here tonight.
To me, this is so compelling. I think it's the challenge of our lifetimes. And our lifetimes represent the period when the human species will make fateful decisions that will determine the future of human civilization. Now, as to the paralyzing effect of seeing these consequences, that's a real danger. And there are people who go, as I say in the movie, from denial to despair without pausing on the intermediate step. And what denial and despair have in common, what makes the climate crisis so dangerous is that it could literally end civilization. No matter who was president, no matter who was prime minister, if the Congress was the same or the parliament the same, if the people did not feel this sense of urgency, then the changes would not be made. And I don't think anyone can do what really needs to be done unless and until there is a sea change in the way the public feels about this issue. In my country, one of our founders, James Madison, wrote that the most important bulwark of a democracy is a well-informed citizenry. And the way citizens have been informed on this question has left a lot to be desired. When they are truly confronted with the facts, with the scientific consensus about what we're facing, then they will, I am confident, rightly demand of the politicians in all parties that they start offering really meaningful solutions to the crisis. Go see the movie, read the book, inform yourself in other ways, go to the website, and try to learn as much as you can about the fact that this is by far the most serious crisis civilization has ever faced. It is a genuine planetary emergency. The normal rules of politics should be set aside. When we have an emergency, we respond and do things that we would not otherwise think possible. The maximum that is considered politically feasible today is still short of the minimum that will solve the crisis. And what that means, very clearly and very simply, is that we have to change the minds of the people in the United States and elsewhere in the world. And we have to put the truth before them in a clear and persuasive and undeniable way so that the people, being informed of the truth of our situation, will then demand of the politicians and in the process give them the permissions they need to have some courage to make the dramatic changes that will solve the crisis. But we don't have much time, and it's on our watch. And the only way in a democracy to get the dramatic changes considered by the leaders, whoever they might be, is for the people to really be seized of the crisis and to demand action.
And so the last, well, the only time that I can see in the history of humanity that we've risen up to an occasion is with Pearl Harbor. And so if I say that the day after Pearl Harbor everything changed, I think you know what I mean. You know, General Motors changed from producing cars to producing tanks in, I think, about 6 weeks. And so what this shows is that we can make the necessary changes very, very fast if we need to, but we just have to have the political will and the public will to do so. We have to realise, the world has to come to realise that it is in the same position as the United States was with regards to Pearl Harbor many years ago. But the difference now is that people don't actually know the extent of the problem or even realise the fact that global warming is happening right now. It's not happening 50 years in the future. In Australia, the sea level has already risen by 70 millimetres. We're already experiencing drought, and I'm sure we're already experiencing dieback in Canadian forests. And so I think people really need to understand that we need to act now because it's not something that's far off in the future. As Al Gore said, the only way that we can do this, the only way we can bring about the political change is for a massive grassroots movement to arise. And so this is primarily the goal of this RAC roadshow, is to go about and to establish climate action groups. Over 100 of these groups have already been established in Australia and in the US, and ultimately it is our goal to network those groups into a big umbrella group and to really bring about a grassroots movement, probably of the likes that the world has never seen, and of course in conjunction with as many groups as are interested. And so what we are suggesting is two things. We've given away two CDs, and I'll show you them. We've got one by Ross Galtspan and John Seed on climate change, despair and empowerment, that John Seed and Ross Galtspan did a few years ago. And so we're giving this away and suggesting that people have like Tupperware parties, but climate change style, and get together with their friends and their family and start learning about the issue of climate change and start, I mean, you could like write letters to politicians at the end of those little climate change Tupperware parties if you like. We've also got another one called Boiling Point, which is the full video of Ross Galtspan, a segment of which you saw earlier. The other thing that we are seeking to do is, as I mentioned before, establish a grassroots network, and I'd like to invite people here to start doing that. And so if I was to ask if people here were interested in beginning a conversation, an ongoing conversation about what they would like to do and what they'd see in their communities, would people here be interested? Yeah? Yes. Okay. Yeah, woohoo! So I'm going to like pass a sheet around and invite you people to sign up. I'd just like to mention that it's actually two-sided, and so we're minimising paper. So to conclude, I'd like to show you one more segment, one more DVD of a lady called Vandana Shiva, who's a pretty prominent activist in the area of genetic engineering and the patenting of seeds in India, and she's here speaking on global warming. After that, I'd like to invite everybody here to start that conversation and introduce yourself to your neighbours and really just have a chat on climate change. You can ask me questions, but be warned, I'm not a climatologist, as I mentioned at the beginning of the evening, so I may or may not be able to answer your questions. But the chances are, with the amount of people here, that someone here will be able to. So the important thing is really to start this conversation. And so we'll show you Vandana Shiva first.
And we are in a situation where we are literally preparing to wipe out the capacity of our species to survive on this planet. The planet will carry on. It'll adjust. It'll regulate itself in new patterns. The planet will carry on regardless. But the conditions that human beings need for survival, we are changing that so dramatically that I think our generation is going to see within its lifetime conditions become so severe for living. Not because people don't have enough incomes, but because the ecological burden of a false growth model is catching up with us. And I believe now's the time for every sane person to go beyond this insanity and join hands to just have one project, maintaining the conditions of human survival on this planet. And that's the ecological challenge.
Actually, I'd like to invite Fred back up if you want to talk about Communities for Climate Action. And so this, I'll let him tell you all about it in a bit more detail than he did earlier, but with people's permission, I'd like to circulate that list that's going along to this already established group. And so rather than fragment the community, we start to mesh the community together and to bring about more effective action. So I'll hand you over to Fred.
Make a few comments, and then Kelly, shall we have people talk with one another, and then we'll have discussion questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Before we go further, I would like us to express our appreciation to Kelly for coming here.
That was Australian activist Kelly Tudhope, a graduate of law and social sciences, turned climate evangelist. She presented the multimedia Climate Change Despair and Empowerment Roadshow, which is sweeping down dozens of cities on the West Coast. This evening was arranged by the Western Canada Wilderness Group at the Vancouver Planetarium, August 15, 2007. It was recorded by Radio EcoShock. You can download this full speech from the Climate Files at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Burn it to a CD, several CDs. Pass them out. Get the word out. Find out more about the Climate Roadshow and upcoming dates near you at www.climate.net.au. That's climate.net.au. In Vancouver, the Western Canada Wilderness is at wildernesscommittee.org. And thanks to the Vancouver Planetarium, which decided to put the planet back in planetarium. The view from space shows a troubled planet, and this is another institution that wants to be part of the solution.
From senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
You saw what happened when Katrina wiped out half an American city. The government was unable to act. All our governments are unable to move on the coming climate crisis, much less the extinctions of species on the land and in the sea. Don't wait for big corporations to save the planet. Join these groups, get out to the meetings, become part of the movement. Next week, we'll go to another hall. Over 400 people ditched the Friday night bar scene or the mall and gathered for a screening of Gregory Greene's new film, Escape from Suburbia. If you haven't heard about that film, check out our full program review and interview on Radio EcoShock, the August 10th show. It's on our website, ecoshock.org. But this crowd didn't just passively watch a film and go away, as we've all been trained to do. They stayed for the panel of five speakers and talked till the hall closed down. It was a new mix of peak oil people and climate change environmentalists, finally realizing the solutions are the same, localize and get off the fossil fuel addiction. Rex Weiler, the historian of Greenpeace, was there among a fine panel of activists and critics.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Check out your local nonprofit, college, and community station for our show. If they don't have it, ask for it. Any station can get our broadcast free every week. If you miss the live broadcast, download it later from the website at www.ecoshock.org. Next week, peak oil meets climate change as people just like you work out ways to escape from suburbia. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening. And thanks for all the fine comments we've had from people all over the world. You can always write to us at radio@ecoshock.org.
Those were the days when I packed three microphones and 100 feet of cable into my backpack to record authors and activists appearing in Vancouver, Canada. Now most book promotion is done online. There are fewer talks around town. So what do you think? Were we too hopeful 10 years ago when I made that show? Is there still grassroots climate activism? Toss your comments on my show blog at ecoshock.org. That's published every Wednesday in North American time. I'm Alex Smith.
This week, the Electronic Intifada Palestine podcast continues its discussion with food writer Jody Kalia on the publication of her recent book, Palestine on a Plate.
The electronic intifada.
I was just having an interview with a lovely lady called Vered Gutman from Haaretz. She asked me, you know, like, do you get upset about all the Israeli restaurants that are opening in London and the Jewish food? And I said, so of course I get upset when matlube is the dish of the day in an Israeli restaurant. I'm frustrated because the word is Arabic and it's Palestinian very traditionally, and sakhan was also the dish of the week in another place. I said to her, it's almost insulting. Of course they can make it and they can cook it and feed it to people and it's no issue, but when it's labeled under a different, it's like we make pasta and pizza and it's Palestinian pasta. It's not. It's almost absurd to do things like this. So I felt while I was writing it to really sort of, of course, all the food comes from everywhere and then it ends up in one specific area and it becomes their you know, sort of staple. But I felt frustrated and aggravated that people were enjoying msabbaha and saying, oh my God, amazing Israeli msabbaha, delicious breakfast. I'm thinking, no, actually it's not. And this is the book. It's obviously not a political book, but it is by default because of the title. And I really wanted it to have an identity, like you know, the Gaza kitchen and Palestine on a plate. I didn't want it to be, you know, lemons and roses or whatever.
Sure.
I think they're beautiful titles. I just didn't think that it was me and it would lose the whole point of the book. For me, in this instance, maybe if I write another book number 2, 3, 5, they can all have different things. But the identity was to really be captured in this.
Yeah, absolutely. You touched on a lot of things, questions that I actually was about to ask you. So, you spoke a little bit about, I mean, you talked about obviously food as identity. Perhaps even would you consider food, you know, or cuisine kind of as a locator or a key, you know, to connect with one's homeland in the absence of that homeland or in the face of displacement when there is no, you know, physical space.
I think so. And I think, you know, again, this all started sort of by default. I lost my business. I started working in an estate agency, just like as an emergency job. I didn't know what to do. And my friend was telling me, you know, why don't you start posting things about what you've been writing for the last God knows how many years. I said to him, and do what with it? Who cares about Palestine and Palestinians, and no one cares about us? And, you know, it was stupid to say that because within like a few weeks, he set up an Instagram account. He started creating an app for me with my recipes from my blog. And slowly things started to grow. And it was a shock because he sent me a message saying, hi, you have a page on Instagram and there's like 7,000 people following already and it's only been 2 weeks.
Interesting. Yeah.
What the hell's Instagram? I didn't even know what it was. And it just sort of escalated from there. And I really was surprised in a really nice way to think that people were actually interested. And they're not Arabs and they're not Palestinians. They're other people who know about us and care about us and want to make people know that it is Palestinian food. And, you know, you have the occasional Lebanese or Syrian or whatever shouting at me saying, you know, fasulia o lahme is not Palestinian. And I said, yeah, it's not, but it's Palestinian because my grandmother made it while she lived in Palestine. It's not saying it is the only, you know, place you can cook it. It's just she didn't know anything before she left Palestine to Syria. So it's her version of it. And yes, we're close to each other. And I didn't write this to say like all these are just Palestinian. It's just what she cooked and made them her own and passed them on to us. And really, I think this sort of social media world helped to escalate this project, which was really something private initially, and then my friend made it unprivate.
Yeah.
And I was really happy to see this. It made me feel, and then obviously lots of Palestinians were writing to me telling me this is great and thank you for showing this and telling people that, you know, this is what it is and, you know, correcting things politely without having fights. And
isn't it funny how you always feel somebody like over your shoulder or this need to be so correct and proprietous about, you know, who owns what and what, you know? Yeah, no. So actually, and then just as a follow up, do you feel, I know we talked a little bit about, you know, Palestinian food as identity and so forth. Do you feel there's more of an urgency to this sentiment when it comes to Palestinian cuisine? You know, and sometimes, again, I'm being a little philosophical here, but I sometimes wonder, does our food risk becoming, you know, more of a symbol rather than simply something we can embrace for what it is? Or do we necessarily need to categorize it? Can it just be both? You know, what's your take on that?
I think both. I think it should be a symbol. I think, you know, food is, it gets people together, you know, it's delicious, which is one of the best things about it. I think it should be symbolic to us in a nice way, obviously not in a fanatical way. I don't think anything when it's an extreme works. And if you target things in a certain way, people will listen and they'll see and they'll try. And I think it's important to have the identity. Definitely, yeah. I think it's something that we should keep going if we can, as much as we can, without, you know, a lot of people tell me things, you know, like, you know, how can you say that Jews can't say it's their food? I said, of course they can say it's their food, because there were Jews living there before, and my grandmother's neighbors were Jews, and they were a different type of Jews to the ones that are coming now. It's not the same. So the ones who originally were there grew up with this culture, and the ones who came later came from Eastern Europe, and they came with different foods. So to that, for them to sort of claim it as their own after they've been eating cabbage and I don't know what other pickled things that they were having, obviously this is very you know, condensed and cut down, but that's the frustrating part. It's not that we have to say that Jews can't eat it. It's absolutely not at all the point of the you know, this context of the story. It's just you cannot appropriate everything, and we are becoming louder, and we're lucky that we have social media and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. I don't know how to use them all, but
well, you're a step ahead of me. I'm active on Twitter, but Instagram I still don't quite get. So, and I feel bad. My brother's always saying to me, you're not taking advantage of social media. I'm like, I can't keep up with three kids and this, and, you know, no, it's like you feel like you need to pick one. No, you seriously, you feel like, I feel like I could just live my life just pressing buttons, you know, but.
Don't do that. Pick one and stick to it. It doesn't work with me. I don't get it. I don't know how people do things. I don't know what it means, but whatever way you use it.
For sure.
It's good. And, you know, I see all these things about people being silenced and being blocked. My Instagram was blocked 50 times and I didn't know what was going on.
Right.
And I was calling my friend saying, I can't post anything. My page has disappeared. I don't know what. And then I get a message from Instagram saying someone's reported your page.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, for what? And they said for racism. And I, you know,
that happened to me. I mean, I don't have I have an active blog now. But when I did, that happened to me once with Blogger. And
eventually they realized my page is about food and there was nothing racist about it.
For sure.
It hasn't happened for a very long time.
Oh,
but,
that's, you know, no, I did want to actually, again, you touched on something I was going to ask you about later, but I'll just jump to that. Cultural appropriation. So, you know, this is something we get asked about a lot, or have been asked about a lot over, you know, it's always something that comes up. I think initially people assumed it was, our project was kind of like a kumbaya project. And then when they kind of read more into it, they realized that it wasn't, but we frequently get asked about this, and we, you know, our usual response, we coined this phrase of hummus kumbaya, that we're, you know, inherently opposed to the concept of hummus kumbaya, and that it's not as simple as breaking bread and so forth. And like you were saying, it's loaded, right? It's not a matter of just cooking the food. It's
what I like to quote this phrase that somebody I was speaking with said, that it's like eating the other, right? So it's invisibilizing, yeah, invisibilizing the other's history, in the words of Frantz Fanon, devaluing their culture and their history and so forth. So it goes beyond, above and beyond. But I wanted to ask how you, I mean, you touched on it a little bit, so you don't need to go over it again if you don't want to, but how you have personally dealt with this issue of appropriation and or invisibilization of Palestinian cuisine.
I think when this book, I gave, the manuscript to my agent, right, and she sent it out to most publishers here, obviously not publishers that have published the Middle Eastern cookbook because they're just not going to compete with themselves. I was rejected by every single one of them because of the title. And a lot of them came back saying, if she changes the title, we might consider it. And I told my agent, I'm not living to write a cookbook. I have a life. I have a job. I make money. I survive. I'm happy. This book is an addition to my life, but there's no way I'm changing the title, because that's the whole point of the book. If you're going to change the title, you basically deleted the book already, because that's the point. I wanted to say Palestine on the title. So this was the first challenge of already trying to not silence, but delete the most important word that makes the book what it is. And then my publisher really saw beyond the title, and she loved the book, and she likes to write specific books about very specific parts of the world, not just the Middle East.
What
she
was did this one Michelle Buck?
This is the UK.
Ah, okay, got it. Okay.
And Michelle had already heard about me because of a lovely lady called Fiona Dunlop, who's a freelance food and travel writer, who came to my supper club. She called him, and he's published a couple of her books, and she told him about me, and then he was going to contact me, and then my publisher signed me up, and she contacted him and told him, I've got a girl that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the point, again, about Palestine and appropriation, and, you know, I felt already slightly, like, on edge that already they want to change the book by calling it something, you know, my fragrant kitchen or my, you know, whatever.
And it's not even as, quote, unquote, I use controversy again between quotations, but it's not even remotely controversial in the sense of there's nothing in there that you... But anyway, you answered my next question, which was about the challenges that you faced. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Asked the agent to tell me like why they rejected the book. And she said to me, some people don't know where Palestine is. It's not recognized as a country. How can they publish a book about a country that's not there? And I said to her, listen, you're sort of treading on thin ice here. She's like, it's not me. I'm just reading what they've written. I said, no, of course, I'm not upset with you. I'm just saying that, you know, I hope you said something, because you're just saying that a whole group of people, millions of us, don't exist because the country is not recognized on a map. It was. I mean, it is. And then I explained to my publisher why I was writing the book, and that I felt that in the last few years, every Middle Eastern restaurant is Israeli. Literally every single one. Not one Arab owns them. They're all from Israel, and they've been brought here, funded, opening beautiful. Don't get me wrong, they're delicious. I haven't eaten in them personally because I just don't. But my friends have been, and their food is great, but it's Msakhan, Msabbaha, Ma'lube, and a million other things.
And it's a slap in the face. I mean, I...
Literally a kick in your teeth. and I got upset. And I wanted to kind of show that actually there is a history to all this food. And yes, it's very cool now to have tahine on everything and za'atar sprinkled on dukka, whatever. But there was this stuff came from somebody and somewhere and a people, and now it's labeled as something else. And it was very frustrating. Of course, I cannot change the London scene, and it's not my point. It's just that I think people should know that was something before Israel, and those people created this style of cooking and this food that is now being broadcast and sort of shown all over the world. And identity is number one for me. you know, a lot of people tell me, you know, I'm not Palestinian because I was born in Syria. That's fine. Yeah. I have no issue with that, but I am Palestinian because...
Well, that's what I was telling you about people always using this against you in some way. Yes, but you were born in Kuwait. Yes, but are you really... You didn't actually grow up there, and so therefore...
Really? Right. really. More than you know.
For sure.
So I don't fight with anybody about anything because I just think some people are ignorant. They don't want to listen and I don't care about them. I know who I am. I don't need anyone to tell me, you know, where I'm from or where I'm not. And, oh, you know, one girl said to me, your accent is so British. You can't be Palestinian.
Yeah. I said, I did that. And I actually now I have to preface every talk I give by, I know everyone's going to, you're not going to hear anything else I say, so I'm going to answer this question at the beginning. I have an American accent because, like, X, Y, Z, you know, I went to an international school, and so now that we've, you know, answered that, you know, burning question, I'm going to get on to my presentation.
What do you expect? And she's Palestinian, and she attacked me and attacked me and attacked me, and I was sitting there, I said, so why are you so angry with me?
Yeah,
have I done something to offend you? I'm British. And I live in England and I've lived in London all my life. And so I'm not Palestinian. She said, you're not Palestinian enough.
The electronic intifada.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Morris Pearl, chair of the group Patriotic Millionaires, who explains why he believes the Republican-controlled House vote to repeal Dodd-Frank banking regulations is courting disaster. Alden Meyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who assesses the ability of the newly formed U.S. Climate Alliance to bypass Donald Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement and influence policy outcomes on climate change. And Melissa Mays, a water crisis activist from Flint, Michigan, who discusses the current crisis of Flint's water contamination crisis and recent charges of manslaughter filed against city and state officials. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A week after Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt imposed an embargo on Qatar, the pain in the monarchy's capital, Doha, was growing. Dairy products briefly disappeared from stores before food aid came from Turkey and Iran. The embargo also led to a shortage of U.S. dollars used to pay foreign workers who make up nearly 90% of Qatar's population. Tensions between Qatar and Saudi Arabia have been building for over 20 years and escalated after Qatar became an economic powerhouse in exporting liquefied natural gas. The hereditary monarchy also pursued an independent foreign policy that included support for the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas while developing friendlier ties with Iran. Saudi Arabia and its Persian Gulf allies are also angry at Qatar for underwriting the Al Jazeera news agency, which gave extensive coverage to dissidents and their grievances during the Arab Spring uprisings in 2011. On Capitol Hill, a coalition of groups funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE are pushing for U.S. sanctions against Qatar in response to its support of Hamas. Sanctions would be imposed to ban exports to Qatar of defense technologies, arms, and loans totaling over $10 million. Al Jazeera reports this reflects growing linkages between hawkish Israeli groups, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. Throughout the Qatar crisis, the Trump administration has issued conflicting and often contradictory policy positions. 50 years after the U.S. Supreme Court legalized interracial marriages in the Loving decision, one in six couples in America is racially mixed. Still, hostility to interracial couples remains an enduring undercurrent in the American psyche. Angela Ross, a white Virginia woman who married a black man in 2008, recalls being warned, "You can be friends with black people, but don't ever marry a black man." In the Loving case, Mildred Loving, a racially mixed black woman, and her white husband, Richard Loving, were arrested in their bedroom in 1958 by Virginia police, months after they were married in Washington, D.C. It took nearly a decade before the Supreme Court overturned Virginia's law against interracial marriage. The unanimous ruling upended laws on mixed-race marriage in 16 other states. Today, according to a recent Pew Research report, only 14% of those who are not black say they would object if a close relative married a black person. A quarter of newly married Asian and Latino spouses have a partner of a different race or ethnicity. The number of interracial marriages that include a black partner has tripled since 1980. However, there is a stark political split in how Americans feel about interracial marriage. About half of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents say that growing numbers of people marrying others of different races is good for society, compared to only about a quarter of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. 1 year after the massacre at the gay Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, black and Latino survivors and their loved ones are struggling to recover in the face of the stigma of being part of the LGBTQ community of color. The attack at the Pulse nightclub was the deadliest mass shooting in American history, and the massacre created new divisions in Orlando. Many black and Latinos who frequented the Pulse club were outed with the news coverage and then faced hostility in their own communities. Pulse was a place where a diverse spectrum of people could feel comfortable, according to the Miami Herald. However, the black community feels it has been sidelined in the narrative of the attack and its fallout. Unmarried LGBTQ couples with families have trouble accessing benefits in a system that wasn't built for their partnerships. Overall, city government was ill-equipped to handle this tragedy in the LGBTQ community of color. Cha-Cha Davis, a former club promoter at Pulse, who now serves as an advocate for Orlando's minority gay residents, says many in the LGBTQ black community feel like double minorities, excluded from their racial community for their sexual orientation and from the larger LGBTQ community because of their race. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed the so-called Financial Choice Act on June 8th that would gut the 2010 Dodd-Frank banking regulation law by a party-line vote of 233-186. The overall objective of the GOP bill is to eliminate much of the oversight of the nation's banks that was imposed after the 2008 financial meltdown, the worst economic crisis in the U.S. since the Great Depression. Despite Trump administration and Republican Party claims that the Dodd-Frank regulations have hobbled U.S. banks, Wall Street and banks large and small across the nation have been healthy and profitable since the passage of Dodd-Frank. If approved by the U.S. Senate, the legislation would remove rules to prevent risky investment strategies that could trigger another banking crisis, weaken protections for mortgage borrowers and military veterans, and restrict predatory lenders. The bill would also erode the enforcement power of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, established in 2011. Your reporter spoke with Morris Pearl, chair of the group Patriotic Millionaires, who's a former managing director of BlackRock Incorporated, one of the largest investment firms in the world. Here, Pearl explains why he believes the GOP vote to severely weaken the Dodd-Frank banking regulations law is courting disaster.
We had a huge financial crisis starting in 2008. the year before Obama took over as president. That was caused in part by a lot of things, but in part by really reckless behavior of some of the bank executives. Now, the Republican Congress is trying to convince America that was actually caused by the Dodd-Frank Act that was signed in July of 2010, that somehow that's the reason why small businesses had trouble getting bank loans back in that time, even though it was about 2 years later that the Dodd-Frank Act was signed. So we think it's just ridiculous. They want to kind of turn back the clock. We go through cycles of sort of the banks having lots of power and the government regulators getting more power. And now the Congress, the Republican-controlled Congress, really wants to turn the clock back and says the government regulators, the representatives, the people have too much power, and we need to give more power to the banks and the bank executives who run those banks. And I just think that's wrong. You know, we were not in the right place before that was passed in 2000, you know, prior to 2010. We had a huge crisis, and we brought in some new laws and rules and regulations to prevent another crisis like that, to prevent some of the problems. And now the Republican Congress says, no, that was a bad idea, and they want to undo all of that. And it's just wrong. It's wrong for America. It's wrong for small businesses. It's wrong for investors. And in particular, it's even wrong for most banks. It's not going to help the banks to turn that back. The United States and New York, where I live, is the financial capital of the world because of our strong regulatory infrastructure, because our government regulators give people all over the world confidence to send their money to invest in America. And if we want to be less regulated, well, there's lots of countries with less regulation. You could send your money to lots of countries if you want an unregulated financial system. That's not the way it's going to succeed for America.
Morris, just a final question here.
Sure.
If the Senate does pass some of these key House provisions in this legislation and critical parts of the Dodd-Frank bill are removed or eroded, what is the jeopardy the nation faces overall? Are we going to see a return to credit default swaps and derivatives that were abused by so many on Wall Street that in part triggered the financial crisis we saw hit the country and the world in 2008?
I don't know if we're going to see the exact same problem again. Probably not. The people who, you know, there are still people that remember 2008. It's been only 9 years. What we'll see is the executives who run the banks going back to the attitude that, well, if I make a lot of money, if I do something really risky, it might win, it might lose. Like if you bet on black in a roulette table, you might win, you might lose. Well, if I win, I'll make a huge amount of money, be able to retire and support my family, rest of my life without having to work anymore. And if I lose, well, I'll lose my job and I'll get another job. And the taxpayers will, you know, be stuck with it. That's where we're going back to. And I don't think that's good. I think that's wrong. It has this huge agency problem because the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is part of the government, guarantees the deposits of the depositors. And if the banks are allowed to take more risk, well, that really means that the government is sort of guaranteeing your deposits. You don't worry about what the bank does when you make a deposit in your checking account. You don't do research on how the bank invests the money or how they make loans, stuff like that. You don't need to because we have an FDIC, which guarantees your deposits. And so there's no invisible hand of the marketplace saying, oh, people won't deposit money in risky banks. Well, they will if the risky bank offers slightly higher interest rates. And so it's a, well, heads I win, tails somebody else loses for the actual people that work in the bank. And that's not good. We will have another crisis. It won't be the exact same thing again. It'll be a different kind of crisis. But we will have another crisis eventually. Yes.
That was Morris Pearl, chair of the group Patriotic Millionaires and former managing director of BlackRock Incorporated, one of the largest investment firms in the world. Find links to more commentary and analysis of the GOP House vote to weaken Dodd-Frank banking regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump's June 1st announcement that his administration is withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord has prompted more coverage in the corporate media of the climate crisis than that of several preceding years. Because the Paris Agreement stipulates that any signatory nation must wait 3 years before finalizing its withdrawal, the first day the U.S. can officially withdraw is November 5, 2020, one day after the next U.S. presidential election. However, Trump announced that his administration would do nothing to fulfill previous climate pledges made by President Obama, so it's not clear how much difference it makes whether the U.S. is officially inside or outside of the voluntary pact, to which all but two nations in the world agreed. But a move the same day as Trump's announcement could offset the effect of policy changes at the federal level to reduce climate pollution. On June 1st, the governors of California, New York, and Washington State announced the formation of the U.S. Climate Alliance, pledging to uphold the objectives of the Paris Agreement by reducing carbon emissions 26% to 28% compared with 2005 levels by the year 2025. Within a few days, the bipartisan group attracted 9 other states and Puerto Rico to join. Later, 10 other U.S. governors, the mayor of Washington, D.C., and hundreds of other mayors of U.S. cities declared they would work toward the same goals without officially joining the alliance. Together, the members and supporters of the alliance comprise 57% of the U.S. population and contribute 40% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alden Meyer, Director of Strategy and Policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who's worked on climate issues for decades. Here he explains how the Climate Alliance can exert influence on local and national policy outcomes on climate change.
The U.S. Climate Alliance, which is a state mechanism, along with more than 1,200 mayors, businesses, investors, and college and university presidents, have announced that they are still in the Paris Agreement, and they will do their utmost to meet the U.S. commitments under Paris. This is a remarkable development. It's obviously greatly welcomed by countries around the world. Just yesterday, the Prime Minister of Fiji, who is the incoming president of the Conference of the Parties to the Framework Agreement, named Governor Jerry Brown of California as his special envoy for state and regional action. And Governor Brown, along with Governor Inslee of Washington State and Governor Kate Brown of Oregon, announced they would all be going to the next climate summit meeting in Bonn, Germany in November. Mayor Bloomberg has been very actively working with representatives of cities and mayors across the country on this issue. And so there's no doubt that there has been a sharp reaction to President Trump's announcement of withdrawing the U.S. from Paris. And these mayors and governors and business leaders and others are trying to make clear that President Trump does not speak for America on this issue, and that there is tremendous support for the Paris Agreement, for climate action, for the clean energy revolution, and all the jobs and economic prosperity that can bring. And they will be taking this message of we are still in to the rest of the world.
Given the federal government's role in this issue, will that make it harder or maybe even impossible for states and cities to take steps to address the climate crisis?
Well, there's two issues here. One is, can the federal government get in the way of state action or local action to reduce emissions? In certain areas, it can. For example, California has the right under the Clean Air Act to set stronger standards for vehicle emissions than the federal government. They have a waiver from the Environmental Protection Agency to exercise that authority. This is one of the concerns California has, is that the Trump administration may try to withdraw that waiver, and that would lead to a court fight over that. The other issue is who represents the United States at these negotiations. Clearly, the states and the cities and the business leaders do not formally represent the United States of America in the negotiations. They can't take positions on behalf of the U.S. or negotiate with other countries, but they can send a very important political signal that major elements of U.S. society remain committed to Paris. They will be doing their best to make sure we meet the emissions reduction commitments that we agreed to under the agreement, and that President Trump and his administration represent a short-term aberration in U.S. climate policy, not a long-term trend, and that after he leaves office, hopefully the next president will return to the table in the negotiations, and the U.S. will be back in formally as a country.
Alden Meyer, considering the governmental entities that are either holding back or pushing forward the transition to a clean energy economy, overall, are you optimistic or not about the big picture?
Well, this is a trend that's been building steam over many years now, and we expect to see more cities and businesses and states join this loose coalition because these officials recognize that climate change is already having impacts on their communities, on their budgets, on their infrastructure, and the less we address the climate crisis, those impacts are only going to get worse. They also understand that the clean energy economy, which is one of the main solutions to climate change, offers tremendous economic development and employment benefits to those who show leadership, which is one of the reasons you've seen both Democratic and Republican governors and legislatures over the last decade or so adopt renewable standards for their utilities, requiring a larger share of electricity generation to come from renewable sources. And these standards are very popular, including in Republican states, because they bring economic, employment, and tax benefits to local communities. So this is a trend we've seen building for a while. I think what President Trump did with his announcement of withdrawal from Paris is galvanize it to come together in a more public and unified way to present a united front, saying that the U.S. is still in as a country, as a society, no matter what the current president says. So that's welcome. But this trend will continue, it will build, and I think it'll be clear to the rest of the world that the United States as a whole is still very committed to climate action, even if our president isn't.
That was Alden Meyer, Director of Strategy and Policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Learn more about the U.S. Climate Alliance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan, continues, with thousands of residents still forced to use bottled water for drinking, cooking, and cleaning. Flint's crisis began in 2014 when an unelected city manager appointed by the governor attempted to save money by changing the town's water source from Lake Huron to the Flint River, triggering lead contamination that endangered the health of the entire population, particularly children. Now, after years of frustration, uncertainty, and protest, the city's residents were surprised and pleased to hear that Michigan's Attorney General, Bill Shute, had charged five city and state officials with involuntary manslaughter for a death resulting from the Flint water crisis. The officials charged, including the state's Health and Human Services Director, Nick Lyon, face allegations of failing to notify and lack of action to stop the outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, allowing the outbreak to continue spreading through Flint's water system. At least 12 residents of Flint died of Legionnaire's disease, with 90 others sickened in two waves of the outbreak in 2015. Despite the allegations of criminal wrongdoing brought against these state officials, Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder has expressed his full support for them and has kept them in their jobs. Your reporter spoke with Melissa Mays, a water crisis activist and founder of the Flint-based group, What Are You Fighting For? Here she discusses the current status of Flint's water contamination crisis and the recent charges filed against city and state officials.
Well, January of 2015, we received a letter at our house that said for the previous 9 months, our water had been contaminated with a cancer-causing byproduct. And we realized that all of the false, you know, it's going to be okay, all the statements that the state and city had made were untrue. And so my husband and I came up with What Are You Fighting For? To be a portal of accurate information. And so we started testing the water and researching to find out what we were being exposed to and who was doing this to us. And along the way, we discovered lead, bacteria, people were dying. And so we've worked with legislature. We have worked to change the laws, not just in Michigan, but in the entire country, because this isn't just happening to Flint. But unfortunately, today is day 1,150 since we have had clean and safe water. So we've been fighting for health care for Flint residents, to have all of the damaged pipes replaced in our homes, in the streets, and the service lines, and to for the people to be held accountable who did this to us, because these were choices that were made.
Well, accountability is certainly in the news this past week. Five Michigan state officials, including some who report directly to Michigan Governor Mitch Snyder, have recently been charged with involuntary manslaughter in connection to an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease that's linked with the Flint water crisis. That outbreak of Legionnaires killed a dozen people in Flint during the contamination crisis. Maybe you could discuss, Melissa, tell our listeners a bit about the context for understanding these charges that have been leveled against these officials by Michigan's state attorney general.
Well, typically for a year, there's 78 cases or 78 deaths from Legionnaires in the entire country. We had 12 in just a year and a half period. The unfortunate part is these people knew about it. That we had people in the health department, we had people working for the county and the state, that their one job was to protect the public health and to let us know if things changed, like an outbreak of a bacteria, something that people could protect themselves from, because you basically inhale the bacteria and the droplets and the steam in the water, so through the showers. So when these cases, and it was like 100 cases and 12 deaths, came up, they went out of their way to actually hide it. And because of this, the doctors didn't know, and we have another 177 deaths from bacterial pneumonia, which is what Legionnaires is, that have gone misdiagnosed, basically, because the doctors, my son had pneumonia in September of 2014, and he was 10, and that was odd for someone to get pneumonia at that point in time. But my doctor, the pediatrician, didn't know to look for Legionnaires, so he didn't, because no one alerted the doctors that there was this huge outbreak. They actually went out of their way to cover it all up, and because of that, people died. So we were fortunate with my son that he was put on the right antibiotic, but other people were not so lucky. So we're looking at about close to 200 people that don't have answers, and there's no way to find justice for them because they lost their loved ones.
Melissa, as you look at these charges being leveled at the state officials, is this too little too late, or are you satisfied that the wheels of justice, although they're slow, are finally starting to move in the right direction?
It's a good start. It's not good enough, but there has to be punishment that for these people that completely did not do their job. They did the opposite. And it needs to go up higher, because at the end of the day, these direct recruits reported to the governor. And his whole thing was running the state of Michigan as a business instead of, you know, a government. And we see that on a national level now. And the scary part about it is that profit was put over people the entire time. In these emails going back and forth, they were more worried about backlash and how much this was going to cost and what this was going to do, rather than saving these people's lives. Because again, even though we're seeing these charges, no one is in jail, and we want them to live in Flint. We want them to shower in the burning, blistering showers that we have to deal with, and worrying, you know, is this shower going to make me sick? Is this water going to hurt my kids? Do these filters work? I mean, there's too many unanswered questions, because again, at the end of the day, we still can't use our water, and there's no end in sight for that.
Melissa, I've read some opinion in Flint that residents there are really pushing for an indictment of Governor Snyder himself for his role in this crisis. What's your view of Governor Snyder, and what should be the next step in terms of legal cases being developed around the Flint water crisis?
Oh, I absolutely agree, because Governor Snyder decided to take away the democratic responsibilities and rights of the Flint residents and our elected officials locally, and have the state be the complete dictatorship, is basically what the emergency manager law is. To settle a bottom line, he put one person in that was unappointed, or that he appointed and that was unelected, that answered only to him. And so there was no way that he could say that he didn't know what was going on. Well, when you set up an emergency manager dictatorship structure and you put yourself in complete charge of it, you have to be completely prepared to deal with the consequences, and you need to be held accountable. And that's where he sits right now. He needs to be held accountable.
That was water crisis activist Melissa Mays, founder of the Flint-based group, What Are You Fighting For? Find links to local and national groups working to ensure the public's access to safe, affordable water by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, WRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
My name is Bernadette Devlin McAllister. Mumia Abu-Jamal's deep and resonant voice has been silenced and censored. I will read to you one of his illuminating commentaries, written on the occasion of Nelson Mandela's visit to Philadelphia in 1993. Its message is still relevant today. These words were handwritten in a solitary confinement cell by a man awaiting execution. Mumia begins with a passage from Mandela's speech that quotes Frederick Douglass. What to a prisoner is the 4th of July? At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability, and could I reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm and stern rebuke, for it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened, the conscience of the nation must be roused, the propriety of the nation must be startled, the hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all the other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. To the slave, your shouts of liberty and equality are hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. End quote. Frederick Douglass on July the 5th, 1852. July 4th, 1993, saw African National Congress President Nelson Mandela in Philadelphia, quoting this Frederick Douglass speech as he accepted the Liberty Medal, along with South African State President F.W. de Klerk. If the joint presence of Mandela and de Klerk were not enough to stir controversy, then the award presenters, Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell and U.S. President Clinton, certainly stoked controversy amongst radicals. Hundreds of black Philadelphians, while certainly admirers of Mandela, took umbrage at de Klerk's presence. Although we, the awarders, are known as we, the people, Philadelphia, the actual everyday people of Philadelphia had little say in choosing the Liberty Medal awardees, and less say in rejecting the widely unpopular honoree de Klerk. The choice of Liberty Medalists was not made by the people, but by corporate Philadelphia, big business. Why? Why were the people, many of whom had worked for more than 20 years against apartheid and for Mandela's release, frozen out? Their protests against de Klerk all but ignored. When the African majority takes power in South Africa, US big business wants friends there. If one reads the names of corporate sponsors of the Liberty Medal, it sounds like roll call of the Chamber of Commerce, Unisys Corp, Pennsylvania Bell, and the like. Mandela, who has not voted in a government election in 74 years, and de Klerk, president by way of an election counting only minority non-black votes, has only the hope of liberty. No more. The white majority in South Africa has done its level best to stifle African liberty for 300 years. The African majority, even after the awards, still isn't free.
Is riveting. A woman is wrapped with rage, her voice slow and controlled as a cop points a gun at her, as her lover bleeds his life away beside her, and her baby daughter looks on in what can only be called wonder. Philando Castile is dying as a discussion goes on, but it isn't with him, it's about him. The cop's gun quivers and quakes, pointed at this woman, as the cop's voice quivers and quakes, fear thick in every breath. The cop, Geronimo Yanez, has just killed Philando, and he attempts to explain why. He was moving. He was reaching for a gun, he said. Castillo was reaching, his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, said, for his wallet, where his driving license and gun permit was held. Why were they stopped? Yanez said, a broken taillight. Just hours ago, a jury relieved Yanez of his anxiety by finding him not guilty of manslaughter. A jury believed Yanez's tale that the black man was a robbery suspect. The jury believed, once again, that a black life had no intrinsic value and that it could be treated like trash, burned up, and discarded, like an old pair of shoes. Philando Castile's name joins a list as long as life, sacrificed on the altar of white fear. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Should be led by businessmen. This has especially been so in the case of the U.S. presidency. It has been over 6 months with a businessman at the helm of the ship of state. And what do we see? If we're honest, we must admit it has been a disaster. Government, to the extent that there is one, is largely dysfunctional. It runs hither and yon from one emergency to another, solving no problems and creating many. It insults and demeans allies, as shown perhaps best by Germany's Angela Merkel, who announced that henceforth Europe could no longer rely on the Americans and would go its own way. Insults may sell newspapers, but it alienates friends. Government and business are two different things, and like oil and water, they don't blend well. Millions of Americans believe that one's wealth was a sign of one's wisdom. The late John Kenneth Galbraith, an acclaimed economist, challenged that common belief, noting, "One of the things you must understand about 1929, here he speaks of the Great Depression, is the danger in attributing intelligence to the simple fact that people are associated with large sums of money are large financial institutions. We don't ask whether they're intelligent. We say they're associated with all this money, so they must be intelligent. We attribute intelligence to association with financial operations, and only afterwards do we discover that error and that people involved can be extremely successful in gulling themselves, that they can, in effect, and I use the word advisedly, be marvelously stupid." A lesson from economist John Kenneth Galbraith. Look at where we're at now. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Thank you.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour Summer Series. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs broadcast produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation, in partnership with the Center for Research on Globalization. Our shows air on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States and are podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are airing a speech by Gordon Laxer at Winnipeg's Millennium Library in the Carol Shields Auditorium on the topic of energy and ecological security for Canadians while phasing out the production of Alberta's oil sands. Gordon Laxer is a political economist and professor emeritus at the University of Alberta. He is the founding director and former head of the university's Parkland Institute, a non-corporate research institute that does public policy research to serve the public interest. He is the author of several books, including Open for Business, The Roots of Foreign Ownership in Canada, from Oxford University Press, which received the John Porter Award for Best Book Written About Canada. He's also the author of the 2015 book After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians, which was shortlisted for the John W. Defoe Book Prize in 2016 and was hailed by acclaimed consumer activist Ralph Nader as, quote, a myth-destroying blockbuster book, unquote. After the Sands forms the foundation for the talk he gave in Winnipeg on June 1, 2016. Laxer argues that Canada has more than enough fossil fuel energy, as well as renewable sources like hydropower, solar, wind, and biomass, to be able to transition to a low-carbon future. However, vested interests, including big oil, and corporate trade deals like NAFTA restrain the country from being able to make ambitious targets for its climate commitments, such as those in the recent Paris Climate Agreement of 2015. The talk we are about to hear was sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, Manitoba office. Here is Gordon Laxer.
So Winnipeg now has an average of 11 days of over 30 Celsius hot days, but it's going to rise to almost 50 hot days by the 2070s if we allow climate change to go in the direction that it's going. And then by the 2070s, Winnipeg's summer climate will resemble that of present-day North Texas. I say these things at the start because I'm going to be talking about phasing out Alberta sands to combat the climate chaos. Big oil blocks Canada getting to a low-carbon future. Martin Lukács, a Canadian journalist who writes for the Guardian newspaper, lives in Montreal. He calls big oil the arsonists of the Fort Mac fire. So I'm not going to be saying much good about big oil, but I do care a lot about what happens to the oil workers and their families. And a key, the green transition is a key to securing the future for them and for all Canadians. The Paris climate agreements in December was wonderful to see 195 countries get together, leaders, and actually agree to a very strong agreement in aspirations to keep the world below 2 degrees Celsius rise above pre-industrial levels, and if possible, to keep it down to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's difficult to do because we've already risen 1 degree. But the Paris agreements were incredibly weak on delivery. So basically they said, okay, we've got these aspirations, and now each country is going to have to come up with its own plan. Well, and they're going to have to come up with a unique roadmap. Well, Canada doesn't have a plan, and I wrote the book After the Sands to give Canada one. I finished the book before the Paris talks, but everybody knew that we had to do this. Well, Bernie Sanders inspires millions of young Americans with his promise of a political revolution to end the influence of big money on U.S. politics and to vastly reduce the obscene inequalities between the super rich and the rest. Well, why not a similar revolution in Canada to accomplish those things, but also to end the stranglehold of big, mainly foreign oil on Canada? We've got to change course. Ed Struzik, who is an award-winning environmental author who worked at the Edmonton Journal for decades, he writes that fire scientists and fire managers saw fires like the ones at Fort Mac coming in 2009. They were aware that fires were burning bigger, hotter, faster, and in more unpredictable ways than ever before. And this was from their 2009 report. And they said, we're exceeding thresholds all the time. Well, climate change is the main reason why the area burned in Canada each year has doubled since the 1970s, and why the number of fires is likely to double or even triple in the decades to come, writes Struzik. For every degree of warming, there needs to be 15% more precipitation to keep the fine combustible fuels on the ground sufficiently moist. So if temperatures rise by about 3 degrees by the end of the century, we're going to need 45% more rain, and that is not slated to happen. So this is why I wrote After the Sands, to show Canadians how disastrous our present course is, and to give a path and to provide Canadians with a strategy of how to remake Canada into a socially just, low-carbon society over the next 2 or 3 decades. Now, that's ambitious, very ambitious, but it is what we need to do. Well, After the Sands complements the work of others, like Naomi Klein's wonderful book, This Changes Everything, and, of course, the documentary. I know Naomi Klein was here a couple of months ago. But also the documentary. How many people saw the documentary of the same name? I saw it. I'm now living in Gravenhurst, Ontario, and 150 people there saw the documentary. And, of course, the inspiring LEAP manifesto that adopts Indigenous perspectives and brings together settlers and Indigenous people so well. So my work is part of this widening river that is going to carry us to a better place. But it adds a unique perspective. Well, despite Trudeau's lofty Paris refrain that Canada is back, Ottawa has still, at the moment, stuck with Stephen Harper's pathetic climate targets that were submitted before the October election. So now the Liberals have said that they may improve them. And one of the things about the Paris Agreement is that it's a ratchet. You can only ratchet up, not down. And so Canada could, and with pressure, I hope we have enough pressure to say, we're going to go even further than those pathetic targets. Because those targets that Harper submitted were much lower than that of the European Union or the United States. The U.S. and the European Union had agreed to a 2.8% a year cut between now in the 2020s, and Canada's 1.7% cut. So that's if we get down to there. Well, the emissions, I call them the sands. I don't call them the tar sands or the oil sands, because you're either in, you know, immediately, as soon as you open your mouth, you're on one side or the other. So I've adopted this term. Well, the emissions from the sands are not improving. Harper government kept talking about the emissions intensity improving, but they've been flat since 2005. And they're likely to stay flat until 2030. Because even though there's been some technological improvements, they're negated by a shift to more energy-intensive extraction techniques and declining reservoir quality. So they're not actually improving. And I was in Edmonton in November when Rachel Notley, who was a former student of mine, When she announced the Alberta's climate plan, it was just before Premier Notley was going to the Paris talks, and the Alberta government's been given great applause for this. It was quite a sight. The CEOs of the four big sands oil corporations, the ones I had fought for 30 years, stood shoulder to shoulder with Premier Notley. And I was very disturbed to see the CEOs with the widest smiles. So I smelled a rat. So here is the picture of Premier Notley with four of the top CEOs, plus some environmentalists from Pembina and Indigenous leader as well. But I saw why the CEOs smiled. Alberta's climate leadership plan targets the 28% of Alberta's greenhouse gases that come from power generation and transportation, and leaves the 46% of its emissions that come from the production of oil and gas almost scot-free. So under Alberta's plans, the sands and other oil and gas emissions can grow by 43%. So here shows where Alberta's emissions come from. So if you look at the top right, the orange, that is from driving. Now Albertans drive a little bit more. They drive SUVs and big vehicles, but that's only 11% of their emissions. If you look at the green at the bottom there, the 17%, that is from power generation, from coal-fired and natural gas-fired electricity. But the big elephant in the room that no one's talking about is the purple, the 46% that come from the production of oil and gas. And that is Canada's fastest growing source of emissions, is from the production of oil and gas. And it's bigger in Canada as a whole, not just than transportation. And that... no one is really talking about dealing with that. My book, After the Sands, does. The problem is that if the sands are allowed to grow by 43%, they're going to entirely cancel out Alberta's reductions in electric power and vehicles, and also methane reductions. So basically what they're asking is for ordinary Albertans to reduce their carbon pollution so that big oil can expand the sands' emissions and profits. Well, everyone knew that the Alberta Conservatives were in big oil's pocket. Rachel Notley's NDP government plainly is not. It was elected by progressive Albertans as an alternative. And boy, were we ecstatic last May the 5th. I was there for that, and helped pull out the vote. But the NDP government is intimidated by big oil. So being in the pocket of or intimidated by big oil leads to similar results. Now, the motivation's different. The NDP is motivated by a legitimate concern for sands workers. But the Alberta government now urges the building of pipelines to coasts for the sake of national unity. And it's actually much more effective coming from Notley than it was from Alberta Conservative premiers. Well, Alberta's emissions cap is not much of a cap. It should be renamed the Alberta's NDP carbon polluting license that kills Jack Layton's dream. In 2008 and 2010, the House of Commons passed Layton's Climate Action Accountability Act. And the reason it passed was it was a Conservative minority government. So it was all the opposition parties voted for, the Conservatives voted against. And what it said was that Canada must cut its carbon emissions by 80% from the 1990 level of 600 megatons by 2050. Well, Harper got his unelected senators to defeat the bill,
So it didn't become law. But it had great influence, Leighton's bill, because the next year, all G8 countries promised to cut GHG emissions by the 80% by 2050. Ontario's climate plan that was announced a couple of weeks ago used the same Leighton formula, 80% reduction by 2050 from 1990 level. Thank you, Jack Leighton. Well, cutting emissions from 1990 emissions by 80% by 2050 would leave 123 megatons. Now, if Alberta's sands are allowed to go to 100 megatons, and that's what the Alberta Climate Plan says that they can rise to, and we cut everything else, that would leave only 23 megatons above Alberta's sands. And the Alberta sands emissions would take up 81% of all Canada's emissions. So we would have to just about shut down all other oil uses, like driving to work and heating your home, just so big oil can grow Alberta sands output, emissions, and profits. This is an infographic by Dave Hughes, who's a geoscientist. He was with the Geological Survey of Canada for 30 years. I've wrote an op-ed with him. I know Dave well. So what he says, I'm not going to go into any detail in this, but what he shows in the top line is where we must go to reach the Harper-Trudeau 2030 target. And these bottom, what is happening here, this is the production of oil and gas. This is where it is going by 2030. And what that means is in the next, if we're even going to reach that 2030 target, we would have to cut, and if we allow the oil and gas production to have all those emissions, we would have to cut all other emissions for all other uses by about half in 13 and a half years. So you can see the incredible impact of the sands. Here's another way to see it. Alberta has 4.2 million people. Its emissions are higher than Ontario and Quebec combined, with 22 million people. So that's five times the population. And it isn't because Albertans drive a lot more. So that is the incredible impact of the production of oil and sands, the emissions on Alberta's emissions. Well, we must not bank on tomorrow's phantom hope for technologies to save the day. It can justify doing nothing now while big oil keeps fouling the air and profiting. Now, I'm in favor of new technologies if they can help. For example, falling battery prices and greater range for electrical vehicles, I think, are going to make electrical vehicles viable, certainly by the 2020s and maybe even sooner. We see, you know, China has just agreed that 30% of all vehicles, government vehicles, are going to be electric vehicles. In Norway, last year, 25% of all vehicles sold are electric vehicles. So it's starting to come in. And I favor environmentally good technology, technological advances. But we must not wait for some magic new technology as an excuse to do nothing now. Our main problems are lack of political will, and current technologies are sufficient to do the job. Powerful vested interests pressure governments in Canada to have the wrong focus. If the production of oil and natural gas is Canada's greatest source of greenhouse gases, we need a federal provincial plan that will phase out carbon energy exports and start a deep conservation and renewable energy strategy. Well, oil apologists say that Canada's emissions are trivial, so why cut back? It's not going to make any difference. You keep hearing this line. It's an excuse for business as usual, and it's not true. Canada has 0.5% of the world's people, and we are responsible for 1.6% of the world's emissions. That's three times our per capita level. So if what this shows is emissions historically since 1850, so from the, near the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and Canada's in the top 10. Now, if you look at Canada and population in the world, we're about 35th in the world, but we're actually in the top 10 of historical emissions. Now, we're about number 9, but we're still... Canada is the yellow one there, 2%. If you look at current emissions, again, these are the emissions that Canada is responsible for, and here is our percentage of the population. So way higher. We are punching way above our weight, but not in a good direction. And there's no good reason for Canada's CO2 emissions to be twice that of Norway and more than three times that of Sweden per person. Both are cold, sparsely populated countries like Canada, and they have similar standards of living to us. Defenders of big oil ask why Canada should take significant climate action while China builds all those coal-fired electrical generation plants. Well, that argument might have been true 5 years ago, but it's no longer true. China, yes, is the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the world, but China has the most people. And China is starting to take action that puts Canada to shame. Last year, nearly 100% of China's newly installed electricity was from renewables, a record investment of $110 billion. Now, that compares to Trudeau's promise to double infrastructure spending to put $1 billion into green infrastructure. So China is spending 110 times as much as we are. They have 37 times our population, so actually so it's three times as much per capita as we are. China's wind farms generated 145 gigawatts in 2015. I'll tell you what a gigawatt is in a minute. And that is more wind power than Canada's total electric power from all sources. Now, China added an incredible 30 gigawatts of new wind power last year and 16 gigawatts in solar, a world record. China's promises to have 200 gigawatts of wind and 200 gigawatts of solar power within 4 years, by 2020. Combined, that's enough to power 280 million homes for over 800 million people. That would then give power to 60% of China's population from wind and solar power. Well, China's coal use fell 3.7% last year and 2.9% the year before. Now, China is still building new coal-fired generation, and it's the lower-emitting ones and closing out those that are least efficient. It's not good to build any, and China's got a long way to go. But it is starting to make giant strides. China plans to close 1,000 coal mines this year. So we have run out of China excuses. Canada must change course now and join the global move to a low-carbon society, run on conservation and renewables. And After the Sands outlines a bold strategy of how to get there to ensure that all Canadians, including those with lower income, will have access to a sufficient amount of energy as a human right. We keep hearing about carbon taxes and cap and trade. So BC and Alberta have carbon taxes. Quebec has cap and trade. Ontario's bringing one in. They're good, but not nearly sufficient to bring about the scale of emissions that we need. We must take much stronger steps than that. So Canada actually has enough conventional non-fracked oil and natural gas liquids to meet all Canadians' use, but not enough for exporting. So if our largest, we can't control the emission levels if we allow the unlimited growth and export of carbon fuels. So to curb this, Canada must phase out Alberta sands for fuel production and all carbon fuel exports over the next 15 years. It would be the same timetable as Alberta is phasing out its coal-fired electricity. And we can live on non-frack Canadian conventional oil. So as domestic conventional oil output declines, we need a strong conservation plan to reduce Canadians' wasteful carbon energy use at least as quickly. The richest 10% of the world's people cause 50% of global emissions. A carbon tax high enough to curb their carbon pollution will be so high that lower-income people could be stranded in unheated homes and freeze in the dark. In a carbon-constrained future, there's going to be less energy, period. If we let energy prices determine who has access to lower supplies, the rich and the military are going to hog most of it. So in the After the Sands, I outline a fairer and more effective way to reduce emissions than through sky-high carbon taxes. And these are personal tradable energy permits or quotas. They were developed in Britain and passed into legislation there, but not implemented yet. So I'm not going to go into it in any detail here, but individuals are given free weekly carbon permits, but corporations and governments must pay for theirs. Your carbon use is calculated every time you buy carbon energy in one transaction using your credit or debit card. There would be no charge, though, for using renewable energy. So the plan would tilt the playing field toward them and conservation. And it actually lets you determine your own way to move to off-carbon fuels. The 1% and the 10% richest in the world have no more right to emit into the world's common, fragile biosphere than anyone else. Everyone, regardless of income, has the same right to clean air and drinking water. Quebecers and Atlantic Canadians are energy insecure because they import the majority of their oil. Oil is imported from offshore and increasingly from the United States. The train that tragically blew up at Lac Mégantic in Quebec carried fracked shale oil from North Dakota. Now, you may think that U.S. oil, if we import oil from the U.S., is just as secure. You know, it's way more secure than that from the Middle East. Well, think again. I spoke to Matt Simmons, who was the owner of the largest oil investment bank in Houston, and he was an advisor to George W. Bush. And I asked him, I actually called him up and he called me back. He said, if there was an international oil shortage, what would the U.S. do? He said, we would cut Canada, exports off to Canada just like that and take care of ourselves. Well, what would President Trump do in an international oil shortage?
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our summer series, we're airing a talk by Alberta-based political economist Gordon Laxer, which was presented in Winnipeg at the Downtown Millennium Library on June 1st, 2016. The topic is on energy and ecological security for Canadians while phasing out the production of Alberta's oil sands. Here, once again, is Gordon Laxer.
Unlike 26 of the other 28 member countries of the International Energy Agency, and that's the counterpart to OPEC, Canada, so 26 of the 28 have strategic petroleum reserves, Canada does not. And they can help you in a short-term energy shortage. let's say, and let's hope this doesn't happen, but, you know, there could be a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran that would shut off the Persian Gulf, and we would be into that problem. So we certainly need strategic petroleum reserves. We also, of course, need to reduce oil use, doing that and promoting electric cars and transit and all those things will help move Canada towards energy security and independence. Pipelines. I'm going to speak about pipelines for a minute. Why do they cause so much controversy and opposition? Because they're going to lock Canada into continuing to expand sands oil production and emissions and cause environmental devastation in many places. Even before that beast of a fire around Fort Mac, it was an environmental sacrifice zone full of tar pits that leak into rivers, raises cancer deaths among indigenous people and other people in the area, and kills animals. The sands occupy, it's a huge area it occupies, a quarter of Alberta. It's an area bigger than the three maritime provinces, and it's an environmental sacrifice zone. More pipelines it's going to lead to more environmental devastation, oil tankers running aground in the turbulent waters off BC's coast, pipelines bringing bitumen across hundreds of rivers to either the west or east coasts. And unlike conventional oil, bitumen sinks and can't easily be cleaned up, as the people along the Kalamazoo River in Michigan learned in 2010. Pipelines, of course, run roughshod over the rights and lands of many indigenous nations. The Idle No More movement said, it's not a native or a white thing, it's an indigenous worldview thing. It's a protect the earth thing. The Idle No More movement simply wants kids of all colors and ethnicities to have clean drinking water. Well, there are four eras, and I actually go through the four eras of pipelines in Canada. And if I had time, I would show you all of these maps. But let me give you just a very summarized view. Okay, in the 1950s when we started building to the 1970s, the oil and natural gas pipelines basically ran east-west, delivering Canadian oil and gas to Canadians. Now, some of those oil and natural gas was exported as well, but the lines ran east-west. Then in the 1980s, this was the era of the Free Trade Agreement and then of NAFTA, the 1980s up till 2011, that's the second era. If you look at the maps, and I show them in Chapter 7 of my book, all the new pipelines then ran north-south. So Canadian oil is all going to the United States. What happened in 2011? That's when Obama temporarily stopped the Keystone XL pipeline and shocked big oil in Canada because they thought anything we pump, they're going to take. And they didn't care. You know, they one customer, and that was fine. But as soon as that happened, and of course Obama made it permanent in 2015, the stopping of the Keystone XL pipeline. But right as soon as 2011, you hear all of these proposals to build pipelines to a coast, to any coast, so that they could export oil, export liquefied natural gas off BC. I'll talk about the fourth era in a minute. I want to go back to the second pipeline era from the 1980s to 2011. They were very much part of the ethos and the rules of NAFTA, which of course are called free trade agreements, but they're much more about corporate rule, and something called the Energy Proportionality Clause. How many people have heard of the Energy Proportionality Clause? Okay, a few of you. Well, this is something Canadians really should know. Basically, what it says is that Canada must give the U.S. first access to Canadian oil and gas. So we export 70% of our oil, and the U.S. has first access. So if we were actually running short in this country, there was that war in the Persian Gulf area, and we were shut off from oil, we could not reduce our exports of oil to the United States under NAFTA unless we do it in this. We could do it proportionally. We could actually reduce exports, but we would still have to give them 70% of our oil production. So we could reduce it here. We'd have to reduce it as much in Canada as we did our exports. It also meant that we are obligated to export over 50% of our natural gas to the United States, and they get first dibs on it. So this is even if Canadians are freezing in the dark. When Mexico was confronted with this, they said, no way. We would have to give up our sovereignty. So Mexico got an exemption. It basically doesn't apply to the United States either, because the United States is an oil importing country and is going to continue to be, even with the shale and fracking and horizontal drilling revolution there. The Energy Information Administration in Washington predicts that the U.S. will import between a third and a quarter of all our oil between now and 2035, so even with their production. So this is basically the Canadian clause. It's an energy satellite, energy colonial kind of thing, where you give another, and there is no other agreement like this that gives another country first access to your own energy. So we're gonna have to get rid of that. Now the Energy East pipeline. Okay, so this is of special relevance certainly to Manitoba, but to any province to the east of Alberta. See, in the second period, when you've got exports to the United States, that's all the pipelines are running to the south. Then, you could get oil if you wanted to directly from Alberta to the United States. But if you want to get oil to a coast, Alberta's landlocked, it's going to have to get agreement from other countries. So it's going to have to say, do it as a national plan and dress it up like this is nation building, like the building of the CPR or some kind of nation mythology like that. So this is the third era when you see all of these proposals for pipelines. This is a natural gas, liquefied natural gas off BC. And if you look at it in terms of oil, these are all the different proposals for the export, again, the shipping offshore of oil. The Energy East line is mainly a sands oil export line. Mark Sherman, the plant manager at the Irving Oil Refinery in St. John, New Brunswick, said the Energy East line would send, quote, way more than we would ever use at this refinery, so the bulk of it would all be exported. So this is a sands exporting line. TransCanada talks about this as replacing oil in oil imports from the Middle East. That is nonsense. The Enbridge pipeline that went from Ontario to Montreal now supplies the two Quebec refineries with most of the oil, partly from Western Canada and partly from U.S. shale, especially from North Dakota. But the Energy East pipeline is not needed. The current pipelines to the U.S. Gulf Coast now have sufficient spare capacity because the international oil price crashed in the last year and a half, and it mothballed much of Alberta's future oil output. So almost half of the oil projects canceled in the world last year were in Alberta sands. Peter Terzakian, a prominent Calgary energy economist, says none of the 17 major sands projects withdrawn in the last 18 months will likely revive, even if oil prices rebound. And a pipeline to New Brunswick, 4,600 kilometers from Alberta, is not needed when Newfoundland has enough conventional non-fracked oil to supply all of Atlantic Canadians. The problem is now most of it's exported, and Newfoundland gets virtually none of its own oil. So here they, if there was a war in the Middle East and the oil supplies were cut off, Newfoundlanders would literally freeze in the dark, even though they've got their own oil, because they can't use their own oil. The oil is exported. Their refinery, a come-by-chance, doesn't refine their kind of oil. It's a crazy situation, and the Canadian government doesn't address this. The Americans are talking about energy security all the time. We import the same percentage of oil as they do, and we have do no plans for it at all. Because, you know, the Canadian governments have not been looking after Canadians. They're looking after the interests of big oil. And the great thing about using Newfoundland oil is so you don't need a pipeline to New Brunswick. And if you build a pipeline, you would need it full of mainly Sands oil for 30 years to pay off its cost, they amortize the costs. So if you're going to get, if we're going to start moving away from carbon fuels, why would you build a pipeline that you have to keep full for the next 30 years? And by the way, this would be the biggest pipeline in North America at a 1.1 million barrels a day. It would take a capacity a quarter of Canada's total output of oil. Well, the era of oil is nearing its end. Until last year, OPEC and big oil assumed that the oil in the soil would grow in value. And oil corporations are, their share value is determined by how much reserves they have. And it's assumed that it's going to grow in value. But now, big oil and Saudi Arabia especially are beginning to realize that oil may be less valuable in the future. And that's why Saudi Arabia announced Vision 2030 recently to wean the kingdom off dependence on oil. And why it is selling so much oil today, even though that holds down the international price, because they figure it's going to be worth less in the future than it is now. Total, which is France's giant oil corporation, said last week that it will align its business strategy with climate efforts. Some fossil fuel reserves must remain undeveloped, they say. Total will focus on producing moderately priced oil that meets the highest environmental standards. On that basis, and this is a quote from Total, we decided to reduce our exposure to Canada's oil sands. A combination of factors will shrink demand for oil. Government-mandated vehicle efficiency, rising efficiency standards, ending gasoline subsidies in the OPEC countries where the gas has been really cheap, but those countries don't have the money now. They're an incredible deficit. Growing gasoline carbon taxes and cheaper batteries that are starting to shift to electric vehicles. So instead of peak oil, we're now at a point of peak demand. Amy Myers Jaff, a leading oil expert, predicts that world oil use will fall by 20% by 2040. If that happens, oil prices will fall. All it takes is, if you just reduce demand by a couple of million barrels, say out of the 96 million barrels that are produced every day and consumed, that will cut the price. The oil market is very sensitive to a small change in demand. And oil sands, the Alberta sands, new projects need prices of $68 to $100 a barrel, new projects to be profitable. They're now about, today, they're $49. So if Alberta sands don't expand, there's going to be no need for more oil takeaway capacy. So building the energy use pipeline would not help Alberta's economy. Alberta and big oil are on the wrong side of history. They are betting that the age of carbon fuels will continue for decades. That is unlikely. Alberta must now join the international transition to a low-carbon future or be left behind in a fossil fuel backwater of abandoned oil wells and tar ponds that resemble U.S. Rust Belt states and coal states. Now, I was talking earlier about the fourth pipeline era. It hasn't started. We've got to get it starting in the 2020s and 2030s. And this would be the era in which pipelines start to disappear as we transition to a new low-carbon future. And we've got to make, you know, we've got to make, the citizens' movements have got to make sure that that happens. So now is the time to get off carbon fuels. 50,000 sands workers were laid off in Alberta last year, about 2.5% of Alberta's workers. Should Alberta try for another carbon fuel boom? If it happened, it would be followed by a permanent bust. And we should take this opportunity to transition Alberta and Canada to a low-carbon society. Here's how. And after the sands, I outline a plan to do that. So we have to have deep conservation and renewable energy, and it can create more jobs than the failed focus on carbon fuel exports. Manufacturing creates at least 10 times as many jobs per $1 million invested as the petroleum industry, and construction creates at least 8 times as many jobs per $1 million invested. So the majority of workers actually laid off in the sands last year were in construction, building the new projects. Offer them jobs in green jobs, retrofitting all buildings, building a high-speed train from Calgary to Edmonton, public transit LRT, district heating, building new wind, geothermal, and solar power. And this is, some people get it. These are Alberta sands workers. They call themselves Iron and Earth, and they want to retrain 1,000 electrical workers to work on 100 different solar projects. They set up a nonprofit in Fort McMurray, and they're trying to do that. So this is a good kind of example. So we have to realize that a unit of carbon energy saved creates more jobs than a unit of carbon energy dug up, burned, and emitted. We have to bring in a just transition program for energy and construction workers in Alberta sands and other carbon projects to help them move to other useful work. Replace all oil imports with domestic conventional non-fracked oil to give Eastern Canadians oil security, and use the conventional non-fracked as transition to a low-carbon future. Phase out carbon energy exports, oil, coal, natural gas, and NAFTA's proportionality rule. What we should say is we demand, Mexico's in NAFTA, they got an exemption from proportionality, we demand a Mexican exemption. We should phase out Alberta sands for fuel production by 2030. There may still be a role in oil from there in making of plastics, but not as a fuel that's going to be burned and emitted. We've got to phase out electricity exports, and this is something that might... So Manitoba is one of the four great hydro provinces in Canada, BC, Manitoba, Quebec, and Newfoundland. All of the other provinces are all hydro-poor provinces. What I would like to see is the phasing out of the exports and to have interprovincial connections. So if British Columbia could send some of its power, I don't agree with the Bennett Sea Dam that's being built there. I don't think we need more hydro dams because they cause incredible environmental damage. But we can use the ones that are there and add wind and solar and other renewables to that. Saskatchewan is as bad as Alberta in its per capita emissions. Manitoba Hydro could help them get off that. Quebec could get could help Ontario with its emissions, with getting off coal, getting off natural gas-fired electricity and nuclear. And Newfoundland can help Atlantic Canada. Of course, we've got to partner with Indigenous nations as sovereign peoples, respect their stewardship over their traditional lands, and adopt the Indigenous worldview as the Canadian worldview. And the LEAP Manifesto is a great example of Indigenous settler alliances. And we should remember that for virtually all the environmental victories we've had in Canada recently have been led by Indigenous nations.
I'm going to end on a note of optimism. Canadians can do this. So I want to show you this. This is somebody, you know, like me, who's promising all these wonderful things, energy independence, preserve rainforest, sustainability. So there's a man, you know, who's maybe an oil man, stands up there and says, "What if it's a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing?" So energy, eco-energy problems are daunting, but with determination, we can overcome them. Challenges are not what deter humans. We are built with the brains and ingenuity to overcome. But bogus ideas and prophets of doom can divert or discourage us. I wrote After the Sands as a wake-up call to inform and inspire Canadians to act. Our current society is not the best we are capable of. We have to cast off discouragement and join with the tens of thousands of Canadians and millions abroad who are already building new low-carbon societies that are more socially just and far more satisfying. It's time to start now.
That was a talk by political economist and author Gordon Laxer on After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians. The talk was presented at Winnipeg's Millennium Library on June 1, 2016, and sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Manitoba office. A question and answer period followed the main presentation.
Most of the big petrol companies in the world are state-owned. Canada and the United States, it's all mainly privately owned. So we're sort of up against the... our part of the world is set up different economically than the rest of the world in trying to control these oil companies. Like, how do you see that? Like, we have our hands tied compared to the rest of the world, I think.
Well, if you're asking, should Canada nationalize their oil companies so that we can change them, we did have Petro-Canada, and I was a supporter of that in the 70s. But it was supposed to go in and change the oil industry. The problem is they put it in Calgary, and the oil industry changed them, and they became just another oil company, and they acted just like it. And so Canadians lost support for that. I'm in favor of a new kind of public interest ownership, much more bottom-up, not like a big bureaucracy like Petro-Canada, that could be controlled by communities that had a mandate and actually the terms of incorporation, very different from the present corporations, which are you must make a profit for the shareholders. That is their responsibility. So you incorporate it so there'd be non-profit and so that you could get the same company that is providing you with natural gas or electricity, convincing and bringing you solutions to conserve and get less of the stuff that they sell. And I outline, so I call that public interest ownership, so it's broader than the old kind of state ownership. There could be some government ownership in that. I mean, the thing is that with private ownership, the private companies have been getting they've been getting most of the economic rents, the actual value of the land, and they don't deserve any of it because they didn't put the oil in the ground. I mean, that is over and above a normal rate of profit. So and it's I wouldn't want to nationalize the oil companies because here is the problem: if you did it, you would have to pay off the old owners. And they're getting the rents, the economic rents, is built into the share price. And you would have to keep those companies going full bore at what they produce in order to pay them off. So I think that basically we're going to have to come in with really tough environmental legislation, which is going to incredibly lower their share value. If you wanted to take them over, maybe you could at that point when they've been driven down to 10 or 20% of their present value.
But I don't know why you would want to take over the whole ethos and a group of people whose whole mission is to sell more and more of this carbon fuel. I think we have to create different kinds of entities that have an environmental focus built right into their DNA.
Alberta, you said Alberta now, or Canada exports 70% or more of its oil, and we import, what, 40%? To change that, to supply Eastern Canada their own oil, we would have to abrogate NAFTA. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay. It's very simple. All we have to do is give them a six-month notice.
Yes.
And the NDP doesn't have a policy on it, right?
Yes, I mean, you know, you can all say God forbid this, but, you know, President Trump has promised to get rid of NAFTA, so maybe he'll do it for us. But, no, what we should pressure, I think we need a campaign to demand a Mexican exemption. Mexico is in NAFTA. They don't have to do this. Why should we? So what it does is it urges the Canadian government, and they go to the Canadian people and they say, you know, I mean, that's, I think that would, if you put it to Canadians that way, that's fairness, right? So you go to the your NAFTA partners and you demand this. But in your back pocket, you've got the six-month clause. So there is a clause within NAFTA that says that any member can pull out of NAFTA if it gives 6 months' notice. Now, I don't know if you remember the 2008 Democratic race between Obama and Hillary Clinton. In the Ohio primary, where a lot of the Ohio workers were against NAFTA, they fell all over each other to promise to be tough with their NAFTA partners. And Obama said he would pull the trigger on the six-month clause if Mexico didn't agree to labor standards and environment. So, I mean, they talked about getting out of NAFTA. Why shouldn't we? But the way you start with is the Mexican exemption, and if they don't do that, you got to go in and play some hardball, and you have a backup plan if they don't agree.
You've just heard After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians, a talk by political economist Gordon Laxer at Winnipeg's Millennium Library on June 1st, 2016. The talk was recorded by myself, Michael Welch, for radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Gordon Laxer made reference to NAFTA and the Proportional Energy Sharing Clause prohibiting Canadians from withholding energy exports to the United States for energy security, climate, or any other reason. In Canada, the Trudeau government is soliciting feedback as it prepares for renegotiation talks with the Trump administration, which is expected to begin as early as mid-August 2017. Listeners to this program wishing to share their recommendations with the Canadian federal government are encouraged to visit the site www.international.gc.ca, follow the links to Global Affairs Canada, and then the online form Consulting Canadians on the Renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement with the United States and Mexico. The exact link to the online form should be available at the globalresearch.ca website in the Global Research NewsHour subsection under the heading After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians by Gordon Laxer. The deadline for supplying public feedback is July 18th, 2017. The music was Shifting Sands by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the site www.purple-planet.com. The Global Research News Hour will return next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.